And then we take our first steps into a brand new investigation at Meadow Cottage.
In the corner, this thing just started laughing. It was eerie.
Listen to Uncanny on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
BBC News at 6 o'clock on Saturday, the 2nd of November. This is Tina Ritchie. Good morning. Spain is deploying hundreds of additional troops to the region of Valencia, where emergency services have struggled to respond to devastating floods. More than 200 people are now known to have died and dozens are unaccounted for. The floodwaters have overturned vehicles, swept away bridges and covered towns in mud. Thousands of people living in cut-off communities are without electricity. Our correspondent Mark Lowen reports from the city of Valencia.
With every hour, the hope of finding more survivors dwindles. As rescuers reach new areas, picking their way through piles of smashed vehicles, the focus is shifting to retrieving the dead. Many bodies are believed to be in underground garages and car parks, trapped as the floodwaters rose. 500 more soldiers will arrive today, adding to the 1,700 already here. But the authorities are facing severe criticism for a slow response and for failing to warn people of the flooding in advance. Local volunteers have fanned out across the streets to fill the vacuum, clearing, sweeping and talking of abandonment.
Kamala Harris and Donald Trump have held rallies just a few miles apart in the city of Milwaukee in Wisconsin, 3 days before voters across the US decide which one of them will become the next president. Wisconsin is one of the 7 swing states that are expected to determine the outcome. Mr. Trump urged his supporters to vote.
We're leading just about, I think, all 7 swing states we're leading. But don't listen to me now. Don't listen. Just pretend we're one down, right? We're 1 point down, please. We don't want to say, oh, we don't have to vote today, Alice, because he's leading. No, don't do that. We've seen that stuff happen. We don't want to do that.
Ms. Harris had a similar message telling people their vote was their voice and their power. She also promised that bringing down the cost of living would be her top priority if she was elected.
I will give a middle-class tax cut to over 100 million Americans. We will enact the first ever federal ban on corporate price gouging on groceries. And fight to make sure that hardworking Americans can actually afford a place to live.
The Conservatives will announce their new leader this morning. Party members have been choosing between the former business secretary, Kemi Badenoch, and the former Immigration Minister, Robert Jenrick. Here's our political correspondent, Ben Wright.
It's 4 months since the Tories were trounced at the election, and the party hasn't rushed the contest to replace Rishi Sunak as leader. After 6 candidates were winnowed down to a final pair by Conservative MPs, Robert Jenrick and Kemi Badenoch have been slugging it out to win the vote of Tory members. The rival candidates are both from the party's right. Mr. Jenrick put immigration and leaving the European Convention of Human Rights at the centre of his campaign and criticised Kemi Badenoch for having no policies. But she argued the party had to rally around conservative principles first.
The former Home Secretary James Cleverly has said he will not accept a front bench role under the new Conservative leader. Mr. Cleverly was the last candidate knocked out in voting by MPs. He told the Financial Times he'd been liberated after 16 years on the front line of politics. The leading supplier of computer chips for artificial intelligence, NVIDIA, is to join the Dow Jones Industrial Average Index of 30 prominent companies listed on stock exchanges in the US. The move highlights the importance of AI in the American economy. NVIDIA will replace its rival Intel, which used to be the dominant chip maker before suffering a series of setbacks in recent years. The new Manchester United manager, Ruben Amorim, has revealed that he was told by the club it was now or never. He said he wanted to stay with the Portuguese champion Sporting Lisbon until the end of the season and move to Manchester in the summer, but that wasn't acceptable to United. Now with the weather, here's Sarah Keith-Lucas.
Thank you, Tina. Well, things are looking cloudy, mild and mostly dry throughout the course of the weekend. So the weather really not changing in a hurry at the moment. A very settled spell with us. Got a few spots of light rain or drizzle around. And this morning they're affecting parts of East Anglia, the southeast of England. Also Northern Ireland and northwest Scotland seeing a little bit of drizzle. But it is going to be easing away. And then most of us looking dry through the day. Some limited breaks in the cloud. So a little bit of sunshine coming through, especially parts of northeast Scotland, eastern England, perhaps Wales into the afternoon as well. And it's mild with temperatures between about 12 to 15 degrees. Overnight tonight, it's another dry, settled night. Could be a bit of mist and fog like last night, mainly around coasts and hills. And tomorrow, a very similar day. Again, it's dry, it's mostly cloudy. Could be a little bit more sunshine tomorrow, though, compared to today, especially towards the north.
Sarah, thank you. Now, look at the papers. The front page of The Times is dominated by a photograph of a twisted mass of ruined cars blocking a tunnel entrance in Valencia after the devastating floods. The paper says there are fears that the final number of people who've died could reach 400. Sir Keir Starmer uses the Financial Times to reassure markets his government won't become addicted to tax and spend policies after what the paper called a bond market sell-off in the wake of the budget on Wednesday. The Prime Minister writes, "We cannot tax and spend our way to prosperity. Reform," he says, is an essential pillar of his government's agenda. The Daily Telegraph reports that Elon Musk has attacked the announcement in the budget that inheritance tax will now apply to some farmers' agricultural land. In a post on X, the world's richest man said, "We should leave the farmers alone." The paper says Labour MPs want the Treasury to consider raising the threshold at which the tax is applied after being inundated with calls from farming constituents. According to The Guardian, Donald Trump's team already appears to be preparing to challenge the result of the US presidential election if he loses. They're said to have filed a lawsuit in the key swing state of Pennsylvania, alleging voter suppression. The Financial Times homes in on America's latest job creation figures, which have been hit by the strike at Boeing and recent hurricanes. 12,000 positions were created last month, which the paper calls the weakest jobs report by far under Joe Biden. The figure was immediately seized upon by Donald Trump's campaign, which called it a catastrophe. And the Daily Mail reports that the King has ordered Prince Andrew's annual allowance, believed to be around £1 million, to be stopped. It says details of the move emerged in an updated biography of the King by Robert Hardman. The Times says the King's decision may force Prince Andrew to move out of his 30-room home in Windsor Great Park to what the paper describes as the more modest 4-bedroom Frogmore Cottage in Windsor Little Park. And that concludes our look at the papers. Now on Radio 4, we're heading back to the 19th century on this week's Ramblings with Claire Balding.
There's not a cloud in the sky above. It is as bright and as perfect a blue as you could wish for. I've come to the village of Boxford in Suffolk, and I've come here to meet an explorer called Lise Workley. And she's not just any old explorer. She recreates the adventures of women in the mid-19th century and consequently dresses as a female adventurer in the mid-19th century. And she's standing in front of me now with black hobnail boots on, pantaloons, a dress, a belt around the waist, which makes it look very elegant, actually, and a bonnet with a fur band at the bottom of it. And all of this in a red and green and yellow tweed. And it's wool, is it?
Yeah, it's all made of wool from the Scottish borders, which is exactly what the women I followed had in 1838. So, yeah, it's super hot in here.
So why? Why would you walk wearing this?
So I've discovered all these women that did all these amazing things, and part of what I found out when I was reading their books and learning about their journeys is they never actually spoke about how they really felt personally, because they were struggling to be taken seriously at the time, especially with their writing, and so they'd only ever really give facts. So I thought I'll never really understand kind of what they went through on their journeys if I was in sort of modern clothing. So that's why I've chosen to do all these expeditions in the old stuff, to really just get more of an insight into how they would have felt and what they would have gone through.
And who made that for you?
A massive mix of people. So this is what I love about the project and about the outfit. My lovely mum, who's over there, helped me sew the dress and the trousers. And then the shoes were made by this woman called Adele Williamson, who works for Trickers, and they're like the oldest shoe company in the UK. I think 1829 they were founded. And then the hat was made by a woman called Sophie, who makes hats for film. So she made the hat in Wicked She made lots of the sort of Harry Potter hats and stuff like that, and just people that come out of the woodwork and offer their help, and it's amazing.
Just before we leave the pub car park, because we've got tarmac underfoot, can I hear those hobnail boots?
Yeah, so they're a bit like tap shoes. And actually, they're amazing on rock and on natural grounds, but on anything man-made, they're quite slippy.
If you want to see Lise in her full glory, dressed as an adventurer of the 1830s, then have a look at our Instagram account, which is at BBC Ramblings. You are going to change now because I think it's quite a warm day. There was a frost this morning, but the sun has really come out, and I think you might get really sweaty in that. Yeah. Which I realise is part of the reason you wear it, because you want to feel what they felt, but I think probably you don't need to put yourself through that. Not for us. If you want to find us on the map, OS Explorer 196 is where you need to go, which is Sudbury, Hadley and Dedham Vale. And the grid reference for the White Hart Inn, which is where we're starting, is TL963405. Lise has made the change in that she's taken off the hobnail boots and taken off the dress and the culottes or the pantaloons or whatever you want to call them. But she's kept the bonnet on, which means as we walked out of the village of Broxford, there were a few stairs from people going by. We are heading out on a circular route of about 6 miles and almost immediately onto a footpath that is very, very quiet. Far away from the road, there's a stream running down on my right and beautiful willow trees. Lise is preceded by her mother, Lisa, who I guess, Lisa, do you still live in the village?
Yes.
So Lise has very much come home for the weekend. So Lise, tell me about your childhood here.
I mean, it's amazing, really. It was very outdoorsy. We were always outside, always playing. And really wild, I'd say. We were always in the garden, playing in the mud, always climbing trees. And yeah, and then I always think sort of when I got a bit older, teenage years, I always kind of lost that connection a bit with nature. And yeah, and I kind of found it back again now. I'm a bit older, but yeah, I went to the primary school around the corner here, which was amazing. So yeah, it was brilliant. Very lucky.
And what was your first connection with these amazing female adventurers? Because you style yourself as woman with altitude, which I like, by the way, very clever.
So I actually found a book when I was 16 by a woman called Alexandra David Neal, and I'd never heard of her. I didn't actually really know there were any women explorers or adventurers. Never heard of them. I'd only ever been taught about, you know, the famous male ones. And yeah, I was just so amazed that I'd never heard of her. And then I kind of read that when I was 16 and always had this idea in my head that I would follow in her footsteps somehow, just to kind of raise her profile and talk about her, because no one I spoke to had ever really heard of her. And yeah, and then I just started doing some research, and I now have a list of about 150 women from all different parts of the world who did amazing feats that were never given the same recognition as a lot of the men at the time. So that's how this whole thing kind of started. Yeah.
I'm guessing that they almost had to be able to fund themselves, because the one thing you couldn't be in that situation was female and poor, because you just couldn't do it. So they had to be financially advantaged.
Absolutely,
yeah?
And that's why a lot of them actually came from very privileged backgrounds. So Henriette, whose outfit I was wearing earlier, she was from a very wealthy family, and they could, and they had more freedom, because other women who didn't have the money, you know, they had to work. So a lot of them come from that kind of background. But then again, there are others that didn't, because actually some of them, they kind of live with people that they meet when they're traveling. They kind of tried to get things for free. So there were some that did it, I guess, on like a shoestring budget, you could call it.
You work, don't you? Yeah. What do you do? What's your job?
So I've actually worked in PR for the last 10 years, mainly in travel now. But yeah, I always say that's my job I do for money. And then this is my job I do because I'm really passionate about it and I love it. And I do get a bit of money through this, but I put it all back into the trips and sort of supporting the women that help me, like the guides and the filmmakers. And I have to take a holiday to do these trips as well. So, yeah, it's pretty full on.
We were walking on a very, very narrow footpath. Couldn't really walk alongside each other. We've come up onto the edge of a ploughed field now. And actually, I can see the river. So is it called the River Box?
It's actually a lake. There's a little stream that joins it. It's a tributary to the River Box. But here it's formed a lake, which I think is a natural lake, but I think it's been enlarged in the past.
So now we feel as if we're getting out of the village, yes?
Yes, we're heading up the hill. Yes, we have hills. In places, we have hills.
And Lise, what was the story behind Henriette in particular, who you found a really fascinating character, and did you feel some kind of connection with her to want to recreate her journey?
So she's Henriette de Angeville. So she's French, but she actually lived in Geneva. And yes, she just grew up around the Alps and in those mountains, and she always had a fascination. And I guess it's that thing where you can see something your whole life and you think, actually, I want to climb that. And there was a woman who called Marie Paradis, and she actually had gone up 30 years earlier. So Henriette's famous for being the first woman to climb Mont Blanc unaided. So Marie actually went up 30 years earlier, but was carried to the summit because she got really altitude sick. So Henriette was like, well, I want to go up and be the first woman to do it without being carried.
And she succeeded?
And she succeeded, yeah.
Who was with her? What was her team?
So she had 6 male porters and then 3 male guides, which was very common back then. If anyone wanted to go into the mountains, you'd have a huge team, because it's not like now where you can look at the weather app and see what's coming. They could have been gone for 3 days or they could have been gone for 2 weeks. And also, something else I found out was they didn't have crampons then. Crampons weren't invented. So actually, porters that would help them carry things also chiselled foot holes for them the entire way they went. So yeah, just little things like that I found out as well. It's kind of fascinating, and understanding more why they needed that many people.
And it's one thing studying these women. It is another to then want to recreate the specific adventure. What was trying to scale Mont Blanc, what was that like?
Oh, it's so difficult, and it's becoming more difficult to climb because the weather's changing. Back when she was doing it, they had problems because there were blizzards and snowstorms, and she thought she might not be able to get to the top. But we had the total opposite problem now, nearly 200 years later, where it was way too hot, and usually it's snowy by that time of year there, and there'd been no snow, so a lot of the rock was exposed. So we actually had to wait a few days before we were allowed to even attempt it, and then we kind of got halfway up and a storm came, so we had to turn back round, which was obviously very disappointing, but just part of it, you know. And it was kind of experiencing what she might have experienced was all about. So we're going to go back in June and try again when there's supposed to be a lot more snow.
Lisa, from your point of view, A, what's your initial reaction when your daughter says, oh, I'm going to go and climb Mont Blanc, I'm going to do it in this, you know...
In the chronicle.
Yes, which you're going to help make me.
Yes, well, the first time it happened, the David Neil trip, which was back in 2017, I think, wasn't it? That was a bit of a shock, because this was a Himalayan trek right up into the very highest mountains, right up as far as you can get to the Tibetan border. Really, really extreme mountain walking, come climbing in places. And she'd never done it before. We'd never experienced that before as parents. And it was a big shock, and we were very worried. Since then, it's kind of become a bit of the norm, being Lisa's mum, is to see her go off on some strange expedition, dressed in very strange clothes. And we just sort of hope that she'll cope with it in the way she's coped with everything else so far.
You're listening to Ramblings on BBC Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, and today I'm in Suffolk walking with Lise Wortley, otherwise known as Woman with Altitude. She recreates the adventures of female explorers from way back. And actually, you were talking about the trip you took to try and climb Mont Blanc, and for you, you had to, you know, make a plan B, didn't you?
Yeah, so a storm came in and we weren't going to make it, and actually there'd been a fatality the day before and then four more the weekend after that we came down, so we definitely made the right decision there. And then I thought, I'm here, I'm in this outfit, I need to honour Henriette in some way. So I knew there was a mountain that she'd climbed at the very end of her life. It was the last mountain she'd climbed, called the Aldenhorn. It was just across the border in Switzerland. So we all came down the mountain, hopped in a car, which I know she wouldn't have had, but we didn't have much time, and went to the Aldenhorn. And there's a cable car, actually, that takes you all the way up to the glacier. But I said, no, we can't get that. We need to walk like she did. So poor Karen and Grace, who I was with, were like, okay.
Cursing
we'll
you.
Walk. So the path actually went all the way under the cable car, all the way up. So, yeah, and it's this incredible mountain that I'd never even seen a picture of it before, but it's absolutely beautiful, and it's this really unique shape. It's a massive triangle, basically, which I know most mountains are, but then it kind of tables out into a square at the bottom underneath the peak. And it's, yeah, absolutely incredible. So, yeah, we went up there instead, got to the summit.
Obviously, when you're taking on these challenges, you've got to plan it, and you've got to make sure you are fit and ready for it. So what's your training programme like?
So to train for these trips, I actually never really felt the urge to just climb a peak before. I'm not that bothered about just getting to the top, so I thought, oh, hang on, I'm probably going to have to do some quite serious training for this one, because not only am I climbing 4,600 metres, I'm also in an incredibly heavy outfit, and the shoes on their own weigh way more than anything modern does. So, yeah, I just went to all the national parks in the UK, took myself off, walked up and up and down mountains, and then I actually went to the gym for the first time in about 10 years. So I used to get really bad panic attacks, and I had a terrible one in the gym once, and I never went back in. And so this time I was like, well, I have to go to the gym, because how am I going to get my legs stronger? So eventually I kind of went, and after 6 months I felt a lot more comfortable in there. So yeah, I went to the gym, and that was kind of it, and then just hoped that I would be all right.
It clearly is something that fills you with this amazing well of joy.
Yeah, it really does. And I'm really lucky I found this, actually, because I think I was very lost in life for a long time. I just didn't know what I was doing or what I wanted to do. And yeah, I think it's that disconnecting as well from sort of the chaos of modern life. I live in London, so it's chaotic. And actually stripping everything away and going out into nature in this old stuff, I've got a bit addicted to it. And I like that total calm and that quiet, and no one can bother me. I'm sort of doing my thing. So, yeah, got a bit addicted to it already.
What sort of age were you when you felt the uncertainty of life and that sort of slightly stressful, constant feel of anxiety?
I think as a teenager, really. I think when you suddenly start realising more about the world and that you need to find your place and you need to get a job and all this stuff. And then when I moved to a city, actually, and I totally lost that connection with nature and I guess my younger self. And it's all very confusing. I never really knew what I wanted to do. And I always say I sort of ended up doing this accidentally. I didn't want, you know, didn't aim to be an adventurer. And people call me an explorer, but...
Hello, morning. Right.
But yeah, I don't always feel like one of those either.
Yeah. So can I ask you, as you know, mum, how aware were you that Lise was struggling, you know, when she went to London, that there was this conflict?
Well, I think really it started earlier than that, didn't it? More when you were at university. And to be honest, I wasn't that aware at the time how bad it was. And that has been really difficult for me to deal with afterwards, because I feel guilty that I wasn't more aware than I was. At the time it was getting really bad. And I was sort of involved in my own life, my own career. I'm a lawyer, and I was very busy at the time, and I felt perhaps I was just being a bit too busy and not enough of a mum. And yes, it's been something I have had to deal with it, really. I'm just so happy that Lise works her way through it, even though I feel bad that I didn't help.
But you might, you know what, even if you'd been aware, you just might not have been able to be the one that could help.
It could have made things worse.
Really, yes. It could have done.
Well, that's how I have to deal with it, really.
Yeah. Have you ever been tempted, or indeed invited, on any of the adventures?
Invited, no. Tempted, yes. Perhaps, I don't know, I think perhaps I'm now heading for the age when I'd have to think very long and hard about it, although walking is my absolute passion as well.
I think we could find examples of women of your age who have done this, and therefore...
Well, Henriette.
Yes.
Henriette d'Angeville was 69, who's older than me when she climbed the Oldenhorn.
Yeah.
So she was older than me.
So we're carrying on this path. The sign says Blessam Hall, sort of handwritten on the left. There was a mower in action that's just cut out. May well start up. You see the squirrel ahead of us taking the centre of the path. I'm very impressed, at least, that you haven't been tempted to take the bonnet off. Must be quite annoying.
I'm used to it now. The bonnet was actually the most hazardous part of the whole outfit, which I wasn't expecting at all. So when you're climbing up rocks and you're kind of hanging off, you need to look around, you need to look down at your feet. This brim just kept on hitting the rocks and sort of knocking me backwards, kept blowing off with the wind. So yeah, it's actually the most hazardous part of the whole ensemble.
Big hunk of flint just on our right at the base of this tree. And actually, when you look at the fields around, in every churn of that lovely, thick, you know, really fertile soil, there is constant churn of flint. You know, it is completely peppering.
I was pointing at the giant hornet.
Oh, I thought you were looking at the flint. Was there a giant hornet? I missed that. When you're packing your food for these journeys, how authentic are you with that, and how much can you recreate what they had?
Yeah, so try and stick to everything that they would have had back then. So often I get into really big wormholes of, did they have lip balm in 1838? Or it's fascinating what they did have. Were tampons invented?
Oh,
that sort of thing. I love knowing all that stuff. And it turns out the first tampon was actually sort of invented by the Egyptians. So it's really fascinating when you go back to all this stuff. But yeah, so Henriette, when she went up Mont Blanc, obviously there was a lot of them, and they didn't know how long they'd be gone. So they had like 24 roast chickens, 18 bottles of wine, big vats of like barley water they were taking, legs of lamb, all this stuff. But I was already struggling to carry my modern stuff on top of my old stuff because I had to have the modern stuff as a rule. They wouldn't let me up without it. So I just tried to take a little bit of essence of little things that she had. So I took a tiny bottle of wine. But then because we had a really tight window to actually try and summit, Karen, the guide, was very strict with me and she made me take out a lot of the things that I wanted to take up there. So, yeah. It depends on the trip, you know, how much of this stuff I can take, because I'm usually it's just me carrying. So, yeah, it all depends. But I try and stick to what they had.
I love knowing that she had all those roast chickens.
Yeah.
And
funny
wine,
enough,
you know.
she didn't actually eat much of it because she didn't feel that great. So I think she just drank a bit of lemonade the whole climb. Gosh. And the rest was for the porters. And I think the wine was because they didn't really drink. They didn't always trust water back then to be clean. So a lot of people just drank wine. So I think that was where the wine came from. But I couldn't imagine not having any water on that climb. I mean, I'd be so thirsty.
Mm. We skirted around the edge of a big grass field and now come through the hedge to the edge of a field of maize, and the corn is standing at a good sort of 6 foot tall, roasting in the sunshine. I know what I was going to ask you, Lisa. When did you first spot the sort of adventurous spirit in your daughter?
Oh, I think when she was very young. She was the one who was always orchestrating the trips out into the woods near the house, and would have various sort of animal collections, most of them six-legged and or in grub stage, growing in various flower pots and things. And her younger brother used to follow her around like a little dog, just sort of following, being told to do jobs.
I always remember collecting woodlice and being fascinated that they rolled into a little ball.
Yes.
Thinking, wow. And now it's a bit mean. I'd put them in a jar with a bit of grass and try and keep them.
I remember you once raising a brood of mosquito larvae in a bucket and right outside the kitchen window. Mm. And little brother Leo was messing around and managed to knock the bucket over, and I remember you being extremely cross with him and me being rather relieved that we weren't going to be infested by a whole load of pet mosquitoes. I think I was rather the same, though. I used to have pet snails as a child, and I would race them.
And that could take all day.
Yes. And they had names. They all had French names.
Oh, did they?
I still remember my favourite snail was called Marcel.
Marcel the snail.
Properly quirky, yeah. Yeah, says she who bred mosquitoes. Right. Don't point the finger at your mother and go, you're weird.
I think mainly because they're a bit like tadpoles, aren't they, mosquitoes?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I'm not sure you realised they were mosquitoes.
Yeah, exactly. Blood-sucking, disease-carrying. We're on the narrow pavement down into Boxford, past the multicoloured houses that look like Battenberg cake. Some in deep salmon pink, others yellow. There's a pale green, a paler pink next to it, cream up ahead. It's so pretty and quaint. And the White Hart Inn, from where we began, is now looking very tempting, I think, as a lunch stop.
I always thought the lion was buried under this tree.
Well, I don't think anyone's quite sure where the lion's buried, but it's probably under... I heard it was under one of the windows, but, I mean, the tree may have been planted to commemorate Britain the Lion.
But when you say the lion was buried, you actually mean a lion, a real lion.
Yes, well, yes, a female lion that was a pet of the man who owned the pub in the 1920s. And he was a famous star in the motorcycle Wall of Death. And he used to ride his motorcycle around the Wall of Death in what's now the car park of the White Hart, with the lion sometimes riding on the bike with him, apparently. And when the lion died, she was buried somewhere in the grounds of the pub, and there are various views on where she's buried, but either under the front window or under the tree are two of the options.
Well, fascinating to finish here and hear that story of Britain the Lion. I love getting to know the area and walking with you and hearing about the adventures that you've taken, the ones that you're still to do. Good luck with all of that.
Oh, thanks very much. Thanks to Mum for all your knowledge on Boxford.
And for planning the route.
And planning the route, yeah. It's nice to have a break, not planning something myself.
Ramblings is presented by Claire Balding and produced by Karen Greger. It's a BBC Studios production for Radio 4. There's been a strong reaction from farmers to Labour's first budget on Wednesday. We'll be finding out more in Farming Today this week, which is coming up.
On BBC Radio 4.
I think what you'll get from this series is a sense of inspiration.
I said, I'm only 12 years old, and I said, well, what are you doing here? Just looking for someone to sleep. Do you think you'd be able to help me?
Some people can endure really difficult and challenging things and still change their lives, change the way they see themselves and the world.
In that moment, I could have either stayed or I could have ran away. But I just stayed because, well, didn't have anything else.
Life Changing, with me, Dr. Sian Williams, on BBC Sounds and Radio 4, starts next Wednesday morning at 9.
And now for Farming Today this week with Kaz Graham.
Good morning from the collecting ring for the cattle show classes at Bordaway Auction Mart in Carlisle. And as well as the splendid British Blues, Limousins and Charolais heifers that are just having their final grooming and hairspraying in front of me, really that is hairspray that we can hear right now, there are hundreds of farmers here today who are all celebrating British bred livestock at this Agri Expo event being laid on by the H&H Group, who own and run this mart and others across the north. There's a lot of conversation here today about the high quality of the sheep and the cattle on show, but also, as you would guess, about this week's budget and the very real impact it may well have for many farmers. We're going to be discussing the budget throughout today's programme. But I began my visit here speaking to Richard Rankin, who is CEO of the H&H Group.
So this is the Bordaway Agri Expo. I think we're now in the 17th year of this. What you have here is a show where people bring the best of the best to this show. This is the one everyone wants to win, so you've got the best livestock in the whole country.
And we've got some fantastic, massive Simmental cattle just to our right-hand side. And we're standing in front of some of the sheep here as well. Richard, it's been a massive week for farmers, hasn't it? With the Chancellor's budget announcements on inheritance tax on agricultural land, a faster phase out of direct payments in England, and an increase in the minimum wage and national insurance on employers. What is the mood that you've been coming across in farmers here today?
I think they're going to be feeling a little bit bruised, and I think feeling a bit unloved and left out, that most farmers are trying their hardest to raise the best livestock they can, provide the best quality food that they can for us all to eat and enjoy and have homegrown British produce. But yet they feel like they're up against more and more headwinds. And this, I can imagine this feels like to them another headwind, another quite strong headwind, particularly when you start talking about succession and generational planning and what you do next. Where's the family farm go? How are they going to afford to pass it on? That was never a question until 2 days ago. Now it's a question, how are we going to afford to pass this farm on? Nervousness, a lot of nervousness.
You know, some people have said that it is a very challenging budget for farmers, but at the same time, perhaps it could be a real kickstart to some farmers to sort out their succession earlier. There could be an increased amount of energy looking at the future for farming. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I have to agree. I tend to perversely look on the positive side of most things if I can, and I think you're dead right. I think this is an opportunity for people to sit and go, we can't ignore this anymore. We have to actively, proactively grab hold of this and do something about it, to push the conversation around the kitchen table, like, Dad, Granddad, what are you going to do? Because this can't continue. We either do something now or we risk losing parts of the family farm. Potentially, handled right and looked positively, this is a way to kickstart the next generation or the generation after that back into farming and get the farms into their hands and their fresh ideas and fresh energy.
Richard Rankin there. And as Richard mentioned, the big change announced by Rachel Reeves, many farmers are talking about, is that inheritance tax will apply to farms from April 2026. Analysis from the AHDB shows that if we take a farm worth, say, £2 million, they'll need £200,000 to pay the tax. The average UK farm is around 200 acres, and so worth very roughly, because of course this all depends on where it is and what grade of land it is, around £2 to £2.5 million. The government says that allowances include the house and take the threshold at which you have to start paying inheritance tax to £2 million. But assets, including things like buildings, tractors, livestock, things like that, are not included in that. So farmers argue that these assets will take them over the limit. Now, the Treasury says that 75% of estates won't be affected. But this hasn't gone down well with many rural groups. The Tenant Farmers Association said it had huge concerns. The Agricultural Industries Confederation told us that tax rises announced in the budget will increase burdens on businesses and could fuel food price inflation while deterring investment. Victoria Vivian, president of the Country Land and Business Association, told Charlotte Smith a 6.7% increase in the minimum wage and a rise in the amount of national insurance employers will pay will also hit farmers.
That increase to 15% of the employers' contributions will have a significant effect on the farming business, but also on the diversified businesses, which we have been encouraged to move into. But it has a big knock-on effect, because you don't increase minimum wages and NICs without having to increase everybody else's wages alongside it.
Let's talk about what for some is the biggest thing that has happened in this budget, which is that farms will come under inheritance tax. The government might say that what they're doing is trying to stop very rich people avoiding tax by buying up farms, and that will make the whole system fairer for everybody.
I think we have to be really careful to decouple the notion this is a personal wealth tax relief from the fact that this is a business tax relief. If they want to go after people's personal wealth, they have all the tools to do that. This particular tax relief is to help multi-generational farming businesses and businesses have the confidence personally to invest in the future and to go to banks to borrow money to invest in the future. I can't see that a bank is going to have the same confidence to lend over 35 years if they know that a significant proportion of the land might be lost at the next point of inheritance.
Although the government says the exemption will be on top of existing allowances, so it's 1 million on top of existing allowances, which brings it, they say, up to something more like 2 million.
And that's not a very big farm. I have concerns, and they're sort of wider concerns really at the moment, that the government has a picture of what is an acceptable face of farming. It's not actually a commercially viable future picture of farming in the United Kingdom. And I think that we're going to have to take that message back to them.
But what this might mean then is that when the farmer dies and the business and the land is inherited, some of that land will have to be sold, perhaps, to meet that bill. The business, though, might well continue.
The business will be less viable. The smaller the farm gets, the less viable it is. And its wider investment in food security for the future is also diminished, because it will have that lack of investment in the future for efficiency, for intensifying the productivity of the farm. I think this constant eating away at the size of a farm is not going to produce a viable farming or business future.
Victoria Vivian. The Minister for Food Security and Rural Affairs, Daniel Zeichner, has confirmed that next year's farming budget for England remains unchanged at £2.4 billion. After underspends for the past few years, there have been fears that it would be cut. DEFRA says that the 2% efficiency savings that it and other departments must found will be found internally. Well, the National Farmers Union had called for the agriculture budget to be increased. Its president, Tom Bradshaw, told Charlotte he feels let down.
It's just a sense of huge disappointment. We'd been promised by the Prime Minister when he attended our conference that he understood the importance of family farms, and yet the changes really risk undermining them and their future.
The budget, though, has remained the same at £2.4 billion, and the farming minister might think he's done pretty well in this climate to have defended it.
Yeah, we're still trying to find clarity on the budget. We obviously welcome the fact that it's been secured at the £2.4 billion. We know that to deliver all of the ambition, that's nowhere near enough, but in the current climate, you know, we had to manage our expectations. We still want to know what's happened to the £358 million underspend, and that's conversations going on at the moment to see whether it's just disappeared or whether it's still there.
The other thing that's happening is that they are accelerating the end of direct payments. The biggest businesses will see the biggest cuts. Do you think that will have an impact?
I think it's going to have a massive impact. You know, looking at the businesses that produce the country's food, there'll be many there that were planning on that BPS payment being part of their income next year. Be they tenants, be they landowners, that was already included within their budgeting. And to suddenly have it taken away, some farms will reduce their income to 20%, which is going to have a significant impact on their cash flow.
But the logic is that the biggest people will be able to cope with a cut to that basic payment scheme, which everybody has known for ages is being phased out.
Yeah, we were told it would be phased out by 2028. And clearly this is now happening much quicker for those larger businesses. And a lot of those businesses, be they tenants or landowners, you know, will still have the requirement for that cash within their businesses to fund the growing of the crops, their capital repayments on their machinery. And to suddenly have it withdrawn without any ability to plan is going to have a massive impact.
I just want to talk briefly about perhaps the biggest change, which is including farms in inheritance tax. Treasury figures reckon that 75% of estates will be exempt from this.
Again, we need to interrogate the figures there, Charlotte, because there's a feeling that that includes individual fields or small parcels of land that have been sold in recent times. So we really need to understand exactly what that means. I mean, by our figures, we look at the average size of a farm being about 88 hectares, having a value of £2 million without any building or without any house, and trying to generate the income to pay that inheritance tax is just impossible. Unless we expect food prices to rise, and there's absolutely no sign at all that that is going to happen. But we are seeing dramatic increases in the cost of producing food here. The primary ingredients, the cost of producing them is increasing because of this budget, and farming has nothing left to give. It's been bled dry, and it will have to be passed up the supply chain.
But what ministers will say is that what they're trying to do is to stop raids from big money buying agricultural land for tax protection, which has been happening.
If they were trying to close loopholes, then there were different ways of doing that. But we've got family farms that feed one family. We've got family farms that feed four or five families. They're still family businesses. It will have an impact on tenants because the removal of that land from the tenanted market will potentially happen. I don't think anyone has really worked through the repercussions of exactly what this means for our rural economies, for the farming industry, farming community, which is at the heart of those rural economies, and the impact on food production at a time of geopolitical instability around the world. We have to take control of our food production here.
That's Tom Bradshaw, president of the National Farmers Union.
Well, I am in amongst the livestock pens here at this Agri Expo event in Carlisle. There are really top quality sheep, cattle all around me from all over the UK as well. And as well as discussing pedigrees and prices, farmers here today are inevitably talking about the budget. So what are their thoughts?
This inheritance tax thing is going to hit us pretty hard. I think land values are probably reduced by 20%, will they?
I think it'll encourage us sorting out the... What's the word?
Succession that's is the word,
so I think it'll maybe encourage that, because that's something in farming that does generally get left and it can end up in an absolute mess. So, yeah, pros and cons.
I think it's disgraceful. Totally disgraceful what they've done. The next generation.
You're pointing at... You've got
daughter and my son.
Yeah, daughter and son at the moment.
Yeah, they've ruined it for them. There's no chance that they can take on that debt.
This is the inheritance tax.
Yeah, completely. Yeah.
How would it affect your farm? Tell me a little bit about what you do.
Well, we farm 400 acres, suckler cows and sheep. I'm fifth generation. We own it all. We've no money borrowed at the moment, but if we had to, it wouldn't be viable.
Can I ask you what you think about the budget?
Do you know, I'm not really quite sure it's something that is actually going to affect us as such.
Do you own your own farm?
Yes.
And how big is it?
90 acres, so I don't think it's ever going to be in our category. I think we're going to probably sell up and enjoy life rather than thinking about handing it down. So.
Have you told the kids?
No, probably will know now though.
I've come from a farming background, but not a family farm as such. So me and my boyfriend that are wanting to start our own, starting to make us think, is there any point?
I mean, some people would say that if the price of land goes down because land will be included in inheritance tax, there'll maybe be more land around on the market for maybe you and your boyfriend to either buy or to rent out.
It's a fortune at the minute, but if it goes down, it would be better. But then again, if you've got it and then you have kids that you want to pass it on to, it'd have to go again.
People who aren't involved with farming might say, well, you're quite lucky owning all of this land. And isn't it right that farmers also take a little bit of a hit for the public services that need funding, all of those kinds of things?
I understand that, yeah. But how do the smaller family farms pay that amount of tax and still carry on the way that they are? It's going to be really tricky, isn't it?
How old are you?
22.
Is it a family farm you're on?
Yeah. We're about 1,000 cows and about 50, 60 cows. Like my dad and my granddad had it. I have two of my brothers and one of us will take it on, hopefully. Maybe. We're not sure now.
You're not sure now?
Not sure now.
Where are you from? Who are you?
We're from Penrith.
And what do you farm?
We farm beef and sheep. Got a 14-year-old girl who the 19-year-old's into farming and the 14-year-old one's into farming. And to think when they get it passed on, we probably would have to sell stuff. And it's just very demoralising, isn't it, really, to think that somebody in Parliament can do that to us. I don't know, she just needs to get out onto that ground and come and see what they do. And basically, like Keir Starmer, he says he wanted to help the farmers. Well, all he's done is backstabbers, really, hasn't he?
Just some opinions from the Agri Expo here in Carlisle. Well, the Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, said he is listening and that farmers are a very important part of our economy. He pointed out that inheritance tax will be charged at half, so 20% on assets over £2 million, and it is payable over 10 years. He added, and I quote, that he's not putting to one side their concerns, but he does believe that the government has offered farmers a reasonable package. And it's time to plan, because this change won't come into effect until April 2026. Charlotte asked Jason Beadle from Strutton Parker how many farms will be affected.
The vast majority, I think. The £1 million nil rate band, plus any other inheritance tax reliefs that are available, might be worth about £2 million. You add that up, that would cover about a 200-acre farm, but a lot of farms are bigger than that. So it's going to affect most farms, I think.
Although the Treasury thinks that more than 70% won't be affected at all.
I'd be astonished. I think there are about 50 or 60,000 commercial farms, just looking at England alone. And we think that the average size of those is about 150 hectares, so that's a little bit over 300 acres. So a lot of them are going to be affected by this.
It is, though, more than a year before this takes effect, so presumably there are things farmers can do to lessen their liability.
Yes, there are. And a lot of the tax planning tools that were available before the budget are still available. One of the main ones that people, I think, will look at more carefully now is potentially exempt transfers. So this is the ability to transfer assets while you're alive to the next generation. And as long as you survive for 7 years, then that transfer can happen without inheritance tax.
Another suggestion I've seen is that farmers could take out life insurance, which would cover the tax bill once they've died. Is that realistic financially?
It depends on the cost of the premium. If it's a lot, then probably not. And I don't know if that market's really developed yet. What farmers could do is work out their potential inheritance tax liability. So for an average size farm, we think that might be around £500,000. A transfer happens once every generation, let's call it every 40 years. So you divide the £500,000 by 40 years, you get a figure of roughly £14,000 a year that you might have to save to meet that liability. If you work that out per hectare in terms of how much profit that might be, it's just under £40 an acre profit. So that might be a way, rather than an insurance policy, of trying to generate the capital that you need.
What impact do you think this will have on the availability of land for tenant farmers?
I think it's going to reduce it. I think the availability of land to let is probably going to get less. And when tenancies end and it comes back in hand, I think the landowners are probably going to farm it until they've made a decision about what they want to do in terms of future lettings. So it's going to have a negative effect.
What the government's hoping here, they say, is that this will disincentivise people from buying land who really want it to try and avoid inheritance tax. And so it will make land hopefully a bit cheaper and more available to be farmed. Do you think it will have that desired impact on land value?
It might do, but if that's the intention, then it really is a sledgehammer to crack a nut. If you look at the data and who buys land, the non-farmer buyers are probably somewhere between 100 and 200 people a year. And you compare that with 55, 60,000 farms in England. So it's a tiny, tiny proportion.
That's Jason Beadle from Strutt and Parker. You're listening to Farming Today this week on BBC Radio 4, coming from the Agri Expo at Borderway Mart in Carlisle. I've just moved into the sheep section here. Lots and lots of immaculate looking sheep. I tell you, I've never seen sheep quite as white as this that are being shown here today. Now, there was no mention of nature in the Chancellor's speech, something that the Wildlife Trusts highlighted, saying the UK government must commit to long-term strategic funding for nature's recovery and provide greater funding for environmental regulators. They and other conservation charities have also been calling for an increased DEFRA budget to pay for environmental schemes. Richard Benwell from Wildlife and Countryside Link.
Unfortunately, the way that budgets always run is a focus on big spending departments, big growth departments. And of course, people want to hear about how the budget will affect their day-to-day lives. So we would love to see a budget focused on nature and climate. But the important thing is how much money is going to DEFRA and how that money is likely to be spent.
That money stays roughly the same, with, they say, more money going to ELMS, the Environmental Land Management Schemes, than before. But many conservation groups had hoped that there would be a lot more money.
Any objective assessment of the amount of money that we need to spend on nature and climate recovery would see a much bigger boost in spending on environmental land management and on nature-friendly farming. But in the context of a really tight budget, DEFRA has held its own, and there are some good signs that the department is going to prioritise spending on those aspects of the schemes that really do the most work for nature and really reward those farmers who go furthest for investment in our natural environment. The important thing is that this is just a one-year settlement and that in future we see increases in line with the amount that nature needs, and that DEFRA really prioritises those other ways that it can improve our natural environment, working with regulation to drive investment in the private sector into nature-friendly farming so that we hit those critical targets to halt the decline of nature by 2030.
That's Richard Benwell. Well, we also heard this week that farmers in England will also now see a faster phase out of direct payment. Under the EU system, farmers are being paid subsidy based on the amount of land they farmed. That system is being replaced with new schemes, which are different in the four nations of the UK. And while farms in Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland continue to get direct payments at the moment, in England, the phase out started in 2021. So many farmers are already getting about half of what they used to, with payments ending in 2027. It will now be accelerated, with the biggest reductions for those who historically got the biggest payments. This, ministers say, is so that they can put more money into the new environmental land management schemes, which pay farmers for things like improving soil or planting hedges. But many upland farmers say there aren't schemes available for them, and they face a massive cut in income. John Atkinson farms in the Lake District, and he's been speaking to Charlotte.
For me, it's not as big a problem as for other people in the fact that, you know, I didn't have a massive BPS in the first place. But, you know, instead of getting £25,000, I'll be getting £7,000, which is obviously quite a big difference. My biggest issue is that I'm in a conservation scheme and have been for the last 15 years and can't get into a new one because there isn't an option available. So I'm trapped in a time warp, basically, because the payments are 15 years out of date. I want to move on, I want to do more conservation stuff, but there's nothing I can apply for. And because I've got an SSI on my land, Natural England don't want me to go into SFI, they want me to go into a new higher level scheme because I've got lots of special stuff on my land. But then there's no scheme to apply for, so meanwhile I'm £30,000-£40,000 out of pocket.
Now the government says that it's cutting these direct payments so that it can put more money to environmental schemes, including the sustainable farming incentive, which is like the first rung on the ladder, and which, as you say, isn't open to you because your land has got special protected areas on it. So where does that leave you?
But my cash flow is terrible at the moment. You know, I've never been as overdrawn in my life and all my years of farming, and it's very difficult because you're just working hand to mouth, you know, and I don't, it's not a nice situation to be in, really. We've got assets, but we can borrow against them, but we can't sell them overnight or whatever. So it is quite difficult, and we're really, really struggling to keep going.
John Atkinson. Well, we did ask to speak to the Minister for Food Security and Rural Affairs, Daniel Zeichner. He declined our invitation and in a statement said, environmental land management schemes will remain at the centre of our offer for farmers and nature, with a sustainable farming incentive, countryside stewardship higher tier and landscape recovery all continuing. He said he'd make sure that schemes worked for farms that had too often been ignored, such as small, grassland, upland and tenanted farms. And also said, we look forward to working with farmers across the country to continue to improve and evolve our schemes and policies to make them work for farmers and nature. Well, here in the sheep pens, some rosette winners are just making their way back into their pens, and there's a lot more showing to take place here today. There's some beautiful Suffolk lambs in front of me, and they're wearing little tartan coats. So there you go. Right, that's it from us. I'm Kaz Graham. The producer is Beatrice Fenton, and Farming Today is a BBC Audio Bristol production.
Class 46, Beltex lambs up to 40 kilo.
Love a tartan coat. Now on Radio 4, time for a look at the weather with Sarah Keith-Lucas.
Thank you, Tina. Well, we've got a big slow-moving area of high pressure that's dominating our weather at the moment. So that's bringing us a very dry and settled spell, but it's also bringing a lot of clouds, some drizzle, some mistiness as well. This type of weather is sometimes referred to as anticyclonic gloom because all of that cloud and moisture is just trapped underneath the high pressure and it's really got nowhere to go. So what does that mean for us? Well, although the weather's looking mostly dry and settled, I think limited amounts of sunshine over the next few days. Now today we've got a lot of cloud to start the day, a little bit of mist, some hill fog over the higher ground towards Dartmoor, for instance, a little bit of mistiness around the coast of Aberdeenshire as well. Any mist and fog should clear away, and then we're looking at some brighter spells breaking through the cloud, but I think you'll be fairly lucky if you do see them. Perhaps eastern Scotland and eastern England most prone to seeing some sunshine later on. Light winds though, and temperatures still on the mild side for the time of year. Most of us between about 13 to 15 degrees could just see 16 down towards the southeast. Overnight tonight, we keep that dry, settled theme. Where we do see some clearing skies overnight, there could be the odd mist and fog patch forming. Like last night, though, it's still going to be mild, so most of us about 8 to 10 overnight. But under the clearer skies across eastern England and eastern Scotland, could get down into mid-single figures. So that's how we start Sunday. A little bit chilly, especially towards the east. Few mist and fog patches, but another dry day tomorrow. Bit like today, we're going to have a lot of cloud, but there'll be some sunshine, perhaps a little bit more sunshine tomorrow compared to today, especially across some northern areas. But again, light winds and largely dry. That high pressure sticks with us as we head through the coming week as well. I think for the first part of this week, we've got more moisture moving in from the south and southwest. So for Monday and Tuesday, do watch out for some fairly extensive mist and fog, especially across parts of England and Wales too. Heading through the course of next week, though, that should become less of a problem. And as high pressure sticks around, it is looking dry again. Bit more of a southerly flow into the middle of next week, so I think we'll start to see those temperatures edging up a little bit too. Perhaps just the hint of a little bit more rain working into the north and the west by the end of this coming week.
Sarah, thank you. The Today programme is next with Michelle Hussain and Sean Farrington.
Join Americast on the road to the US election.
It's the BBC podcast full of lively chats about politics,
with social media investigations
and experts on the ground.
We'll guide you through all the key moments as the United States chooses which direction to go in next.
Navigate your way to Election Day and beyond.
Americast.
Listen on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
On 92 to 95 FM, on BBC Sounds and on your smart speaker. This is BBC Radio 4.
It's 7 o'clock on Saturday, the 2nd of November. Good morning. This is Today with Sean Farrington in Salford and Michelle Hussain in London. And let's get the headlines this morning. Hundreds of extra troops are being sent to eastern Spain to help in the recovery after devastating floods in which 200 people have died. Polio vaccination is to resume in parts of northern Gaza, where UN agencies have described conditions for the civilian population as apocalyptic. We'll hear from one UN agency working in Gaza at 7:15. And also in the programme, the battle for the female vote in the final days of the US presidential race.
I'm going to do it whether the women like it or not. I'm going to protect them. I'm going to protect them from migrants coming in.
He does not believe women should have the agency and authority to make decisions about their own bodies.
Later, we will speak live to Jonathan Coe about his latest book and the murder mystery alongside the social commentary.
I'm Simon Mundy with your Saturday Sport. We'll be hearing from the legendary All Black, Sean Fitzpatrick, including on the legacy of his friend, the great Jonah Lomu.
Without question, he is the greatest global superstar rugby has ever had. And I don't think we'll ever replicate that ever again. A very humble man. We speak a lot of the All Blacks about humility. He personified that.
The BBC News is read by Tina Ritchie.
Spain is deploying hundreds of additional troops to the region of Valencia, where emergency services have struggled to respond to devastating floods. More than 200 people are known to have died so far, and dozens are unaccounted for. The floodwaters have overturned vehicles, swept away bridges, and covered towns in mud. Thousands of people living in cut-off communities are without electricity. Our correspondent Mark Lowen reports from the city of Valencia.
With every hour and every day, the hope of finding more survivors from Tuesday's catastrophic flooding dwindles. As rescuers reach new areas, picking their way through piles of smashed vehicles, the focus is shifting to retrieving the dead. Many bodies are believed to be in underground garages and car parks, trapped as the floodwaters rose. 500 more soldiers will arrive today, adding to the 1,700 already here. But the authorities are facing severe criticism for a slow response and for failing to warn people of the flooding in advance. Local volunteers have fanned out across the streets to fill the vacuum, clearing, sweeping and talking of abandonment. And yet the regional government, which they blame for mismanagement, has urged them to stay home, saying they risked holding up the emergency services.
Kamala Harris and Donald Trump have held rallies just a few miles apart in the city of Milwaukee in Wisconsin, 3 days before voters decide which one of them will become the next US president. Wisconsin is one of seven contested states that are expected to determine the outcome. Our correspondent Gary O'Donoghue reports from Milwaukee.
It's been a rough week for the former president, on the back foot over comments about women, Hispanics, and a suggestion that one opponent should face something akin to a firing squad. The crowd got some unusual treatment, a large gun-like object firing T-shirts into the audience. But it was the usual message from the candidate.
We're leading just about, I think, all seven swing states we're leading, but don't listen to me now. Just pretend we're one down, right? We're 1 point down, please. We don't want to say, oh, we don't have to vote today, Alice, because he's leading. No, don't do that.
Here in Wisconsin and across the other six swing states, Donald Trump and Kamala Harris are neck and neck. That's why they're ending up in the same places the whole time. This time, the vice president just 6 miles away. She was focusing on the economy, something where she has lagged behind Donald Trump.
I will give a middle-class tax cut to over 100 million Americans. We will enact the first ever federal ban on corporate price gouging on groceries.
It's now a battle for every last vote. No one knows how this one will end.
The World Health Organization says the second round of a mass polio vaccination program for Palestinian children in northern Gaza is to resume. The heads of 15 UN agencies have warned that conditions there are putting people at risk of death from famine and disease. Our correspondent Joe Inwood reports from Jerusalem.
Polio had not been seen in Gaza for 25 years, until August, when it was confirmed a baby was partially paralysed by the virus. A vaccination campaign for more than 500,000 children began soon after, with the first round going relatively smoothly. But a second vaccination is needed. The UN says it reached the centre and south of the strip, but not the north, due to the launch of a major Israeli air and ground assault. They now say they have assurances that a pause in the fighting will allow them to finish the work in Gaza City. The heads of 15 UN humanitarian agencies have warned of apocalyptic conditions in northern Gaza, saying the entire Palestinian population there faced an imminent risk of dying from disease, famine and violence.
The result of the vote to choose a new Conservative Party leader will be announced at an event in central London this morning. Tory members have been choosing between the former Business Secretary Kemi Badenoch and the former Immigration Minister Robert Jenrick. Here's our political correspondent Ben Wright.
It's 4 months since the Tories were trounced at the election, and the party hasn't rushed the contest to replace Rishi Sunak as leader. After six candidates were winnowed down to a final pair by Conservative MPs, Robert Jenrick and Kemi Badenoch have been slugging it out to win the vote of Tory members. The rival candidates are both from the party's right. Mr. Jenrick put immigration and leaving the European Convention of Human Rights at the centre of his campaign and criticised Kemi Badenoch for having no policies. But she argued the party had to rally around Conservative principles first. While polling of Tory members has suggested Kemi Badenoch has a clear lead over Mr. Jenrick, in recent days both candidates have said turnout looked low. Both know too that whoever wins today will take over a wounded party with an electoral mountain to climb.
The former Home Secretary James Cleverly has said he will not accept a frontbench role under the new Conservative leader. Mr. Cleverly was the last candidate knocked out in voting by MPs. He told the Financial Times he'd been liberated after 16 years on the front line of politics. The world's leading supplier of computer chips for artificial intelligence, NVIDIA, is to join the Dow Jones Industrial Average. It will replace the one-time dominant chipmaker Intel, and analysts say the change reflects the global boom in AI technology. The switch will take place on November the 8th. Barry Caffrey reports.
NVIDIA was once a name linked mainly to gaming, but it has emerged as a cornerstone of the global semiconductor industry thanks to the essential role its chips play in powering artificial intelligence. Major tech corporations, including Microsoft, Google and Amazon, depend on NVIDIA's graphics processing units for their AI services. This has driven a sevenfold surge in the company's shares over the past 2 years. It's now valued at more than $3.3 trillion, second only to Apple. Intel's shares have declined 54% this year, making it the worst performer on the index and leaving it with the lowest stock price on the Dow.
Two families are waiting for compensation in what's believed to be the first documented case of babies being switched at birth in the NHS. The families, who are from the West Midlands, say discovering the mistake after 55 years has had huge ramifications. Jenny Kleeman has been speaking to them for The Gift, which is on Radio 4 next week or on BBC Sounds. Some of the names have been changed.
When Tony got the results back of a DNA home testing kit, he was confused. On his family tree, his sister's name was wrong. Instead of Jessica, who he'd grown up with, someone called Claire was listed as his full sibling. When he contacted her, she said her test results had also been baffling. The pair discovered that Claire had been born about the same time and in the same hospital as Jessica. They soon concluded the two women, then aged 55, had been switched at birth. NHS Resolution, which handles complaints against the NHS, has apologised and said the baby swap was an appalling error for which the trust involved had accepted legal liability. It said it was a unique and complex case, and the NHS was still working to agree on the amount of compensation that was due.
Jenny Kleeman reporting.
Thanks, Tina. It is 9 minutes past seven. Hello, Michelle. You can hear me now.
Yes.
I wasn't getting a cup of tea, sure. Honestly.
I was knew here. You were there.
A minor gremlin. Shall we have a look through what's making a few of the main headlines this morning? I mean, as we've been talking about the budget all week, I'll kick off with that one. Sir Keir Starmer, the Prime Minister, writing in the Financial Times this morning, as the FT puts it, in a bid to reassure markets, saying that just as we cannot tax and spend our way to prosperity, nor can we simply spend our way to better public services. And the FT making the point that those bond markets we've talked about so much this week and how much the effective cost of borrowing for the UK government has changed steadied a little bit yesterday, but quote another analyst there, rejecting the budget itself, the market was Mark McCormick from TD Securities, introducing a new fiscal risk premium into the UK. And the Times and the Guardian go with the impact on the care sector. Tax bill for care homes, existential threat, say the Times and the Guardian. Budget may devastate social care.
The weekend edition of The Eye leads on an exclusive survey which suggests the Conservative Party has gained a shock poll lead over Labour for the first time in 3 years in the wake of the budget. The main story for the Daily Mail is that the King has cut off his brother, the Duke of York's financial lifeline, his £1 million a year allowance amid a row over Royal Lodge. That's the house that he lives in, Prince Andrew lives in. The details come from a new edition of Robert Hardman's biography, Charles III, New King, New Court, The Inside Story. And the new chapters include these details that the allowance is being cut off. Sources close to the Duke of York, the Mail says, have long argued that he has a cast-iron long-term lease on the property, the late Queen Mother's former home in Windsor Great Park. He has made clear to the King's advisers they have no right to force him to downsize, and he has rejected suggestions he moved to nearby Frogmore Cottage. Prince Andrew now has to find the money for the upkeep of the huge property as well as his security detail with no visible sign of independent income, the Mail says. The Duke has repeatedly said he can pay for his upkeep, claiming to have found other sources of income relating to his contacts in international trade. But the Mail says His Majesty will be watching with interest. It would obviously need to be an acceptable source of funding, one insider says.
And if, like me, you might be looking to have a bit of a break from the budget later today and read some stuff in the papers, you've got a choice, Michelle. You've got Tom Daley's first knitting show opening in Tokyo, Heidi Klum's ET outfit, or Paul McCartney's cheese and pickle gig treat. I mean, where do you start?
That is quite a impressive feast, isn't it?
It is. I mean, I'm very impressed with Tom Daley, the entrepreneurial aspect of this. This is a glimpse maybe into future business propositions that he may have. His fans, as The Guardian goes with this morning, legion of fans will remember the Tokyo Olympics as the backdrop for his first gold. But it seems that he now has a show on the way. His knitting will take centre stage there. So pretty impressive developments for Tom Daley.
He's been showcasing his knitting and his crochet on Instagram for years, I think, and it really is very good.
Yes, and Heidi Klum's E.T. I haven't seen a better one than that. We managed to get Batman and Robin into the two very little boys in our house. We're into Batman and Robin for the first time, so that was good. Right, let's crack on, shall we? 12 minutes past seven. On to Spain and the latest on the devastating floods there, as hundreds more troops have been sent to Valencia to join emergency teams continuing their search for people still missing. So far, more than 200 people are known to have died, most of them from that region. That number expected to rise, though. And there's been an extension of the red alert weather warning for the south coast. Bethany Bell is our correspondent in Valencia. And Bethany, what's it like there at the moment?
Well, the search for the missing is continuing here. I'm outside a food distribution centre and I've seen volunteers and rescue workers trying to set out and with the grim search those who are still not accounted for. I spoke to one man here and he told me that rescue workers have been searching through an underground garage right next to his parents' house in this area because they fear that several bodies may be in that.
Sorry,
Bethany, we're just going to interrupt you there, Bethany, because as we can hear, the line wasn't getting any stronger there, but we may well try and come back to Bethany if we can. 14 minutes past seven.
Let's take you in the meantime to the situation in Gaza this morning, because apocalyptic is the word that's been used by 15 international humanitarian organisations to describe northern Gaza, where they say the entire population, that's estimated at 400,000 people, is at risk of imminent death. An Israeli offensive against Hamas has been underway for several weeks. Nevertheless, polio vaccination is restarting today in parts of northern Gaza. International journalists continue to be barred from entering the territory, but I spoke earlier to Rosalia Bolin from UNICEF about what she and her colleagues are seeing there.
My education experts, the education team here, has counted 20 schools that were turned into shelters that have been hit in less than a two-week time span. And that results in a very, very high casualty toll, including many children. And the second thing is that those who do survive those bombings are prevented from accessing care. Hospitals are under attack. They're cut off supplies. They can barely function. More generally, the north has been under a siege for a month now, which means that they've been denied basic aid, life-saving supplies, and we really struggle to bring supplies to them. We don't get green light to go. And diseases and the sanitary situation is abhorrent. Just to illustrate, last Thursday I was in the office with my colleague and we received a phone call from a family who's originally from the north. They're now in the south of Gaza, and they were desperate. They were pleading for help. They say there's three orphan children in the north, in Jabalia, in a residential building that had been hit. Their parents have been killed, so these children are on their own. They did survive the bombing. They're ages 4, 7, and 10. But the problem is that these children have fractures, including leg fractures. And so they somehow got the number of one of my colleagues, and they've been asking UNICEF for help. We will be working with the World Health Organization to try to medically evacuate these children. And then we'll see if we can reunite them possibly with their relatives, with their extended family here in the south.
What is your call to Israel? Because the bombings that you're talking about of schools and residential buildings, I assume that you are talking about the Israeli army.
Most simply is an immediate and sustainable ceasefire now without delay, an end to the bombings, but also the release of the hostages, the immediate and unconditional release of the hostages that still remain in Gaza. It's been more than a war. It's been almost 13 months of relentless suffering, bombings, deprivation, displacement, continued displacement, and that needs to end.
The reason I ask about Israel is that they must believe that Hamas are in locations that are being hit, that they're hitting, such as residential buildings and schools. So what is the way that you think they could separate the fighting with Hamas from the civilian population?
I understand why you're interested in that. I understand why you're asking that that question, but as to how wars are waged, I'm not well placed to speak to that. What we see is that children are bearing the brunt. Children are the ones who are paying the price for this war. They did not start this war. They live in makeshift tents. It's cold. They don't have sufficiently nutritious food. They're out of school. And that's what matters to us.
Amid all of this, for the polio vaccination campaign to be restarting in parts of northern Gaza, how is that possible?
So the campaign is indeed restarting today for 3 days after being postponed from last week. But the reality is that the conditions just aren't really there to roll out such a complex operation. It's logistically highly complex, but more than anything, this beyond the logistics, we need safety for the health workers doing the vaccinations and for the families to be able to reach these vaccination points. What we've been doing is to develop what we call micro plans in humanitarian jargon to try to reach as many shelters as possible. We have a humanitarian pause from 6 a.m. to 4 p.m. today and over the next 2 days. There's been important displacement from the most northern part of Gaza to Gaza City. So we want to use that to try and reach those children who have been displaced. There's 106 sites throughout northern Gaza where we will be conducting the vaccination campaign. But we need to reach a target of 90% coverage to really be able to interrupt the transmission of the virus.
Rosalia Bollin from UNICEF, thank you.
Now it is 19 minutes past seven, and after almost 4 months and a very steady whittling down of candidates from six to the final two, we find out today who will become the leader of the opposition, leader of the Conservative Party, Kemi Badenoch or Robert Jenrick. One of them will be announced as the winner at just after 11 o'clock this morning at a hotel in London. Tim Montgomery, founder of Conservative Home, joins us now. Morning, Tim.
Good morning, Sean.
Who's it going to be?
Ah, well, so close. I'm not sure whether I'd be sensible to predict.
Okay.
I think it will be Kemi Badenoch, but we don't have to long to wait now at long last.
No. I mean, how different in the hours and the days after we get that announcement at 11-ish this morning, how different will the party be depending on who wins?
Well, the big challenge the Conservative Party has is to reunite the right. The huge advantage the Conservative Party's had in the post-war period is that the left has been divided between the Liberals and Labour and Greens and SNP, etc. But the Conservative Party have dominated the right of British politics. I think the election of Conservative leader looks more worthwhile than it did do a few months ago because of Labour's troubles. But that challenge is the big one that still persists. Can the Conservative Party reunite all the people that have gone to support reform in recent years?
And just even reuniting within the party, Tim, you know, from the people you speak to, we've heard James Cleverly in the last day or so, who missed out on making the final two, saying he won't serve in either's front bench, whoever wins. You know, we've heard plenty of bad blood between Kemi Badenoch and Robert Jenrick. The infighting is not just going to stop at lunchtime, is it?
No, I think that is a really crucial factor. When you have people like Jeremy Hunt and James Cleverly stepping down, you only have 121 Conservative MPs after all, so it's hard to staff the opposition effectively. So it's vital that these two final candidates, whoever wins, Kemi Badenoch and Robert Jenrick, and you're right to say, Sean, there has been bad blood between them and their camps. They have to find a way of working together, because otherwise the Conservative Party's splits, which have been notorious over recent years, are only going to continue.
Tim, we will await 11 o'clock. Thank you. Tim Montgomery, founder of Conservative Home.
22 minutes past seven, the COVID inquiry heard evidence this week from people who struggled to access healthcare in the pandemic and what that meant for them and their families, and also about the decision to tell 2 million of the most vulnerable in society that they needed to shield and avoid all face-to-face contact with others. Our health reporter Jim Reid, who's following every step of the proceedings, reports.
You have been deaf since birth?
Yes.
Your husband is also deaf and a BSL user?
Yes.
A first for the inquiry this week, as Dr. Sarah Powell gave evidence through an interpreter in BSL, or British Sign Language.
And you have two sons who are hearing?
Yes.
She told the inquiry how both she and her husband caught COVID early in the pandemic, but the NHS helpline could not deal with deaf patients, and when her husband deteriorated, she again struggled to get help.
At that time, there was no 999 BSL, you know, no 99 service, so you had to do an emergency text to 999 and explain. I explained that my husband couldn't breathe. He was sweating profusely. Absolute panic. It was a terrible moment. It was, you know, life or death. My husband couldn't breathe. So I had to use my son for communication. And I don't know what it was like for him. I can only imagine.
Take a breath, Dr. Powell. Take a breath.
His oxygen level was really low, and they decided to take him to hospital.
In hospital, Dr. Powell's husband narrowly avoided being put on a ventilator. Like millions of others, though, she also had her own long-term health problems linked to COVID, persistent symptoms like muscle pain and extreme fatigue.
I accept that there's still not much known in terms of the treatment for long COVID. I do understand that. But what I want is that acceptance that long COVID is a thing, and that's really important for me.
I do solemnly, sincerely and truly.
The inquiry then heard more about how some of the most vulnerable in society were treated in the pandemic.
That the evidence I shall give.
Leslie Moore's adopted son has cerebral palsy.
He has very complex, severe learning difficulties, and he is gastrostomy fed, which means he's nil by mouth.
Like 2 million others, she received a letter telling her son to shield, that is to stay at home at all times and avoid all contacts apart from medical care.
Can you tell us a little bit about your experience, just you and your son, shielding for a number of months initially?
Really, it was just surviving, day-to-day surviving. It's very hard being in a house by yourself with your son 24 hours a day.
Leslie's son did not catch COVID through that time. Overall, though, research for the inquiry found those asked to shield did not appear to have lower infection rates. Professor Helen Snooks said that's because they were more likely to catch COVID in hospital.
The whole point was to reduce infection rates, and if it couldn't achieve that, whether it be through the overall infection or the hospital-acquired infection, then it doesn't feel to me that we could recommend it in a future pandemic. And it is absolutely not to say that individuals should not or should not have self-isolated. This is not what we're saying here. We're saying as a public health policy, did this work?
My Lady Mayor, call please. Julie Pashley.
Late in the week, the inquiry then heard from Julie Pashley, whose 16-year-old daughter was being treated in a mental health unit at the start of the pandemic.
All the staff had to wear scrubs. They were also wearing masks. So it kind of lost that connection, I suppose, with the ward. So it became a gap between us and them.
At one point, her daughter had to go to A&E, but was then told she couldn't return to her mental health unit for 2 weeks because she was a COVID risk.
What's your overall assessment of the impact of the COVID restrictions on the care and treatment that your daughter received?
I think it potentially delayed any progress in her mental health, any, you know, benefit, really, I suppose. And her getting any better, you know, the trauma that the whole 2 years, 3 years put on our family was horrific.
Over the coming weeks, we're due to hear more about the impacts, not just on COVID patients, but on the backlogs and waiting lists for other conditions that we still see today.
Jim Reid reporting, and just a reminder that on BBC Sounds you'll find the COVID Inquiry podcast, which has Jim's reports all the way back to the start of the inquiry last year.
27 minutes past seven. Let's return to Spain, where those emergency teams continue to search for people missing after the devastating floods. Bethany Bell, our correspondent in Valencia. Bethany, what's it like there at the moment?
Well, I'm with a group of search and rescue teams who are gathering spades, brooms, to undertake the grim task of going through garages and buildings in this little suburb just next to Valencia. It's very, very difficult work. I spoke to one man here and he told me that an garage right next to his parents' home was being searched because it's believed that several bodies may have been in that underground garage. And then another man who said that in a car close to his home, the body of a small baby had been found. The baby's parents, though, he said, were still missing. And he was extremely angry with the local authorities. He said that they knew very well that this was an area prone to flash floodings, and yet over the years they have taken no measures to deal with that problem.
Awful circumstances. Bethany, just briefly, on the south coast now where this red alert's extended, what's expected there?
Well, there's been a forecast for torrential rainfall there and, of course, concerns about what that might mean in terms of flash flooding. And people here very, very much on alert. And at the moment where I am here in Valencia, the sun is shining. But people know that if there is to be more rain here, that will complicate the efforts of the search and rescue team still further.
Bethany, thank you. Bethany Bell, our correspondent there in Valencia.
We'll continue to keep a very close eye on what's happening in Spain, of course. But now at nearly 7:30, Simon Mundy in the sport.
Thank you. We're starting with football, and Ruben Amorim was confirmed as Manchester United's new head coach yesterday. And he promptly acknowledged that he would have preferred to take the job at the end of the season, but accepted a mid-season appointment after being told it was now or never. Amorim will complete his move to Old Trafford from Lisbon club Sporting on the 11th of November. Today sees the start of Rugby Union's Autumn Internationals. It's Scotland against Fiji at 5:40 this evening, but it gets underway with England against three-time world champions New Zealand in Twickenham this afternoon to look ahead to what is always one of, if not the most highly anticipated match for England fans in particular. We can speak now to our rugby correspondent, Chris Jones. Morning, Chris.
Morning, Simon. How's it going?
Very well, thank you. England have run close against the game's top teams in recent matches. You think to that losing by a point to the All Blacks in July, South Africa as well last autumn. So they're getting close. Vice-captain Ben Earl says the time is now to start turning near misses into results. What chance they turn that key corner today, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, they've got every chance. They, as you say, were close away from home in New Zealand. They did have a brilliant win against Ireland at Twickenham, and that was the last time they were at home. And that's been a point that Steve Borthwick, the head coach, has been impressing all week. England haven't played too many games at home recently. They went on tour in the summer. They played the Rugby World Cup in France this time last year, 12, 13 months ago or so. So what a big opportunity this is for England, but it's a really tough one to call. Yes, you'd think that if England got close in New Zealand at home, that home advantage could tell. But the All Blacks have played 8 test matches or so since that series. England haven't played together since July. So that is the big challenge for England. Can they pick up where they left off? Can they show some continuity, some cohesion, and not have to take some time to get back up to speed? Because you know full well the All Blacks will be up to speed from the off come this afternoon. I think that's why Steve Borthwick has tried to go for as settled a selection as possible, just to try and get England to hit the ground running.
New Zealand do seem to be significantly more vulnerable of late than previous incarnations, previous generations. Is that fair? And what do you put that down to?
It is fair, just when you look at the record. You know, they played 6 matches in the Rugby Championship, which is the Southern Hemisphere's version of the Six Nations. Played 6, won 3, lost 3, and for an All Blacks side, that is distinctly mediocre. However, 12 months ago, they were so close to winning the Rugby World Cup. A team that didn't arrive in France hugely fancied showed that they can beat the very best, as they did with Ireland in the quarterfinal, and get so close to actually winning the trophy. And yes, even though it might not be a vintage All Blacks team, the kind of Richie McCaw, Dan Carter or conquering All Blacks team, still got some world-class players on paper, whether that's Cody Taylor at hooker, Ardie Sevier at number 8, Bowden Barrett, fly half, Geordie Barrett, his brother Scott, 3 Barretts in the starting 15, the likes of Will Jordan, Rico Ioane, Mark Teller can wreak havoc as well. So England will have to be very aware, as the Twickenham crowd will be, that even if it's not the best All Blacks team of all time, it's still a very good one.
Chris Jones, loving your enthusiasm. The match kicks off at 3:10 and you can listen to Chris live on BBC Radio 5 Sports Extra and BBC Sounds. He'll be alongside Chris Ashton and Matt Dawson, two players who know what it's like to beat the All Blacks.
Fascinating stuff. Thanks, Simon. With news of tomorrow's edition of Broadcasting House, here's Simon Jack.
Hello. On BH tomorrow, we have a big beast of business to reflect on this week's budget. Seb James hung up his boots as boss of Boots this week. We'll ask him what it means for business and workers. On the way in, we'll know the leader later today of the Conservative Party. How can he or she lead the party back from political purgatory? Plus, a guide to how US elections work from the host of Have I Got News For You, US version, Roy Wood Jr. Join me, Simon Jack, at 9 o'clock tomorrow.
And if you can't wait that long for Simon, he'll also be with us to give us his verdict on the week at 8:10 this morning.
The weather this weekend is going to be mostly cloudy and mild today, with the chance of a few spots of light rain. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4, where Tina Ritchie has a summary of the news.
Hundreds more troops have been deployed to the Spanish region of Valencia, where emergency services are scouring the region to find the dozens of people still missing after fatal floods. More than 200 people are known to have died so far. The authorities are facing severe criticism for not acting quickly enough and not warning people in advance. Towns have been left covered in mud. Thousands of people living in cut-off communities are without electricity. Kamala Harris and Donald Trump have been campaigning in the swing state of Wisconsin, 3 days before voters head to the polls to decide who will be the next president of the United States. The Democratic candidate, Ms. Harris, told a crowd that her Republican rival was bad for the economy, people's health and women's reproductive rights. Mr. Trump latched on to the latest disappointing jobs figures and criticised the number of immigrants entering the US. A pause in fighting has allowed the second round of a mass polio vaccination programme for Palestinian children in northern Gaza to resume. The World Health Organization scheme was suspended last week due to Israel's military offensive against Hamas. However, around 15,000 children are in areas too dangerous to access and won't be able to get a second vaccination. The result of the vote to choose a new Conservative Party leader will be announced at an event in central London this morning. Tory members have been choosing between the former Business Secretary, Kemi Badenoch, and the former Immigration Minister, Robert Jenrick. Both candidates have said turnout looked low. NVIDIA, the world's leading supplier of computer chips for artificial intelligence, is to join the Dow Jones Industrial Average. It will take the place of its rival chipmaker Intel. Analysts say the change reflects the global boom in AI technology. Major tech corporations such as Microsoft and Meta depend on NVIDIA's products for their AI services, driving a sevenfold surge in the company's shares over the past 2 years. The company is currently valued at more than $3.3 trillion.
Thanks, Tina. As Tina was just mentioning, 4 days now until America decides its next president. Campaigning continuing apace. In recent days, there's been fresh criticism of President Trump's comments about women, in particular about former Republican President Liz Cheney, who's now campaigning with Kamala Harris. On Friday, he told Fox News host Tucker Carlson, former Fox News host Tucker Carlson, that Liz Cheney should be under fire with rifles shooting at her. And overnight at a rally in Michigan, he doubled down on those comments.
But if you gave Liz Cheney a gun and put her into battle facing the other side with guns pointing at her, she wouldn't have the courage or the strength or the stamina to even look the enemy in the eye. She wouldn't have. She sits back in Washington. Oh, we ought to go and attack Iran, Iraq. We're going to attack everybody. That's why I broke up with her. Because she, like Kamala, is a stupid person.
Now, Kamala Harris's campaign has criticised what it's called Trump's violent rhetoric. How might all this play with women voters there? American women vote in larger numbers than men in the United States. And among those female voters, it seems the Harris campaign holds a significant lead. The BBC's Samira Hussain reports from Washington.
Please welcome Vice President of the United States, Kamala Harris.
The first woman of color and only the second woman to be a nominee for president.
Kamala Harris, has already shattered glass ceilings. While the Harris team has not made her gender a centerpiece of her pitch to America.
Hi. How are you? Good, how are you?
Good.
Gender is very much on the minds of voters.
Why did you come here today?
Why? This is a very special event. You know, hopefully it'll be the first woman president of the United States.
Do you think this country is ready to elect a woman?
Definitely. I do think it's so. And I really hope so. I know all the women here are definitely feeling that's the case. And I'm hoping that more and more men feel that way as well.
This is the first time in this country that we have a woman of color, multiple ethnicities, running for the highest office in this United States.
Do you think this country is ready to elect a woman?
I don't think they are, but they're about to be. By November 6th, they'll have to be ready. They don't have a choice.
Ladies and gentlemen.
For all his political swagger, former President Donald Trump knows he lags with women voters.
President Donald J. Trump.
But even in the most closely fought states, like Wisconsin, he doesn't seem to have changed the way he speaks about women.
And my people told me about 4 weeks ago, I was saying, no, I want to protect the people. I want to protect the women of our country. I want to protect the women. Sir, please don't say that. Why? They said, we think it's very inappropriate for you to say. So why? I'm president. I want to protect the women of our country. They said. They said, sir, I just think it's inappropriate for you to say, pay these guys a lot of money. Can you believe it? I said, well, I'm going to do it whether the women like it or not. I'm going to protect them. I'm going to protect them from migrants coming in. I'm going to protect them from foreign countries that want to hit us with missiles and lots of other things.
Even women from his own political party have warned Mr. Trump against his embrace of so-called locker room talk.
This is not a time for them to get overly masculine with this bromance thing that they've got going.
Speaking on the American network Fox News, Nikki Haley, the former governor of South Carolina, who ran against the former president for the Republican Party nomination, said his language could alienate women.
They also need to look at how they're talking about women. I mean, this bromance and this masculinity stuff, I mean, it borders on edgy to the point that it's going to make women uncomfortable. That is not the way to win women. That is not the way to win people who are concerned about Trump style.
It's true, he may make some women uncomfortable. But there are women who are more uncomfortable by the thought of a woman in the White House.
I'm still not ready for a woman president. I know some of my friends, when they were on the cycle, you didn't want to be around them.
The right woman at the right time, it's not Kamala Harris. I can't think of a woman. I can't think of anyone that I would want to be the president. Yeah.
And right now, I don't really have a preference, man or woman, just the best person for the job and the best policies.
To a crowd of 75,000 people in Washington, D.C., Kamala Harris delivered her final pitch in this campaign.
I thank you all. God bless you. And may God bless the United States of America. Thank you.
She did so in front of the White House. But is the electorate willing to put her in it?
Samira Hussain reporting from Washington. Listening to that was Dr. Leslie Vinger-Murray, director of the US and Americas program at Chatham House, professor of international relations at SOAS University of London. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Are Donald Trump's words impacting how women vote in this election?
Oh, I think they absolutely are. And of course, we won't know those final numbers for quite a long time. We won't know on election day even. But I think that it's the signs so far, if you look at, there's been a gender gap for a very long time. But if you look at the early voting, the turnout of women in early voting is very high. It's higher than the male vote in some of those key swing states, especially Pennsylvania, where we're all looking. It's turning out low propensity voters that the Democrats have struggled to turn out. And many of these actually that the Republicans under Donald Trump have done well with. We see more low propensity voters turning out on the Democratic side. And the other inroad, which is very interesting, right? The gender gap we've seen for some time between Donald Trump and Kamala Harris. But we're also seeing the Democrats cut through to the non-university educated women. And that really is a demographic that has still, that Trump has done very well with. And he's starting to lose some of those. So this is really, you know, as we're hearing, an election that is going to show a very significant gender gap. It has to show it for Harris. It has to show it in those swing states for it to really matter.
When you talk about that early voting, there's been this advert, hasn't there, in the United States from Julia Roberts, the actress, encouraging women to keep their votes secret from their partners at times. Yeah. What's that all about?
Well, I mean, you know, again, if you many people, we've always assumed that there are many silent Trump voters, people that don't want to admit that they support Donald Trump because their friends or their communities see him as vulgar. And now we're seeing, you know, a silent Harris voters, women who are in red states or in red communities, married to men who are voting for Donald Trump, who are, you know, form part of that narrow base that we talk about. Who are being given permission, as you've said, by Julia Roberts and other leading women, especially in the Democratic Party, but who we suspect, and of course we can't know, are casting votes in private, not telling their communities that they are voting for Kamala Harris, and it's not surprising if you think about the issues on the top of the agenda. Whether it's actually, you know, specifically about abortion and reproductive rights for many of the women who are silently voting for Harris, it may well not be. It may well be about the vulgarity, about, you know, we've seen the Access Hollywood tapes re-released and replayed, the blatant sexism. So women, mothers, women who work, I think we're likely to see this very, very interesting shift towards silent Harris voters.
Dr. Leslie Vinger-Murray from Chatham House and SOAS University of London. Thank you very much.
It is 7:45 and it is happy 50th birthday this week to this. Well, it was in November 1974 that a rubber sandal maker in Japan, whose products were mostly decorated with strawberries, asked young illustrators to come up with new designs. They needed to be kawaii, meaning cute, and the first images of what we now know as Hello Kitty, a white cat with a red bow on its head, went on small purses. It's thought that ever since, the design has generated more than $80 billion for the company Sanrio, and it seems to have been able to appeal to one generation after another, tapping into the popularity of Japanese culture and the anime style of film. Simon May joins us, Professor of Philosophy at King's College London, and he has written about Hello Kitty in his book, The Power of Cute. Good morning, Professor May.
Good morning.
How do you explain or understand the enduring appeal of Hello Kitty?
Well, I think Hello Kitty, like all cute, although it does appear pretty superficial, you know, especially with all the horrors going on in the world, but it appeals to some very deep trends of our age. And so one of them is, I think one of the most important is our tendency to abandon what used to be seen as clear opposites. So, for example, child versus adult. So Kitty's very innocent, but also very knowing, good and bad. So one incarnation of Kitty was as a kamikaze pilot. You know, she's not just a little benevolent thing. Very importantly, human animal. So we no longer think of ourselves on the whole as above the animals or as even as different from the animals, but really as on a spectrum. And in fact, you just introduced, your colleague did Hello Kitty as a little cat. But in fact, according to her creator, she was a little British girl.
Which is interesting in itself. So was that known at the time? I mean, when Hello Kitty was first marketed in Japan, was that seen as a particular part of the appeal?
Yes, I believe that the backstory that Sanrio, you know, which is this hugely successful Japanese company behind Hello Kitty, you know, gave out was that indeed she was this little British girl. And I believe that her name was Kitty White. I mean, she actually had a surname. And she herself had a little pet cat called Charmy Kitty. So anyway, but I mean, my point is that, you know, the most important thing about Kitty and about cute in general is that it blurs these old opposites. And one of the most important, I mustn't leave out, is masculine feminine. So generally, cute objects are not very clearly identified one way or the other. And that also is totally in tune with our age, you know, where gender has become a spectrum rather than just thought of as these absolute opposites.
But the fact that, well, I was going to say she has been so popular. Now I can't, now yes. that you've said Matthew, well, I can't really, so it has been so.
We all refer to her as she, so okay. That's okay.
So, but the fact, the enduring popularity, I'm wondering, is that because as a design, this was ahead of its time in so many ways and others have essentially, not necessarily copied it, but that this is something we've seen more in design over the decades? Or is it that, or is it because of where we are today on the international popularity of anime and the sort of the cult status that so much Japanese culture has?
Yes. I mean, I think that the, you know, cute, I mean, and Kitty in particular, but all cute, which is so largely Japanese, it really works because of the anime style, and in particular because of the kind of, you know, lighthearted, playful, ironic. I mean, if cute were really serious and very literal, it would cease to be cute. And that may be one other reason why it appears to an age that's so full of horrors. Because obviously ours right now is.
Have you bought Hello Kitty merchandise, you know,
I have,
your time?
I can't say, I haven't bought a lot, but I think it is untrue that it's gendered. I mean, it might be slightly biased towards women and young women, but I think, you know, famously, CEOs, male CEOs, female CEOs often have their offices festooned with Hello Kitty.
Interesting. Okay, so would I find a Hello Kitty pencil case on your desk?
No.
Something else.
I don't use pencils anymore, so.
Okay. Thank you so much, Professor Simon May, author of
Pleasure.
The Power of Cute.
Just for tea bags that I carry about the place when I'm going from location to location for me. Now, it is 7:49. Coming up in a few minutes, more on the murder of Holly Newton and whether the definition of domestic violence should be extended to couples under 16. But now, it's time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning is Arkandadi Das, a Vaishnav Hindu teacher and theologian.
Good morning. The Diwali celebrations are underway, but this year Hindu scholars were divided whether to begin festivities on Thursday or Friday, as unusually both nights had no moon. And it's the full darkness of the new moon night that prompts devotees to light the lamps that illuminate Ram's return home. This festival, like many other Hindu events that are linked to the cycles of the sun, moon and stars, reminds us that we are not disconnected from the cosmos. Recently, I was in discussion with a group of astronomers and cosmologists. They lamented what they called the lost sky. Thanks to light and atmospheric pollution, most of us no longer see the night heavens ablaze with stars and the dazzling Milky Way in the same way that our ancestors did. How often does the awe and wonder of the night sky overwhelm and lift our mind above the cares that fill our lives? The James Webb Space Telescope, the most powerful there is, shows us amazing images of the Pillars of Creation and Ring Nebula, but we view them only on tiny screens. Hardly the same emotional impact. Whether we believe ourselves to be products of the laws of nature or the creation of a supreme intelligence, our existence is predicated on the powers that have ordered the cosmos. The Hindu view is that consciousness is beyond time, eternal. As the Gita says, never was there a time when we did not exist. It claims that our consciousness pre-exists the universe and that the universe is a co-creation, an act of God to facilitate our primordial intentions. And so our hopes and aspirations for life and fulfillment in the material realm have been encoded into the unfolding of the structure and order of the cosmos. But also into this co-creation, we injected our conflicting capacities for both love and selfishness. The pressures and challenges of earthly life oblige us to look down, to keep our world small and manageable. We have only limited bandwidth for the troubles of others or to tackle their hurt, injustice and inequality. For Hindus, the connection we should feel with the universe is a reminder that there is a bigger picture to which we all belong. It is meant to reinforce our sense of responsibility to ourselves and to other living beings. As the Prime Minister said on Wednesday, Diwali is a time to celebrate and focus on a brighter future. Hope and conviction flourish when we understand that our actions, prayers, and intentions have power to create the sort of world we wish to live in.
That was Thought for the Day with Vaishnav Hindu teacher and theologian Akandadi Das. It's 8 minutes to eight.
15-year-old Holly Newton was killed in January 2023, stabbed 36 times by 16-year-old Logan MacPhail. The details heard again in court yesterday as her murderer was sentenced. Holly had been in what is now recognised as an abusive relationship, a coercive one with the fellow teenager who would go on to lure her into an alleyway and end her life. Did the age of the two prevent it being seen as such or as domestic abuse? Holly's mother, Michaela Trussler, says that is what her daughter was a victim of.
The only connection it's got is the fact that he killed her with a knife. In all honesty, I think he would have killed her with anything just so she couldn't be with anyone else, because it was all about control, obsession and passion.
Well, the current definition of domestic abuse as it relates to younger victims, there was a key change in 2012 following a public consultation when the age limit for domestic abuse was lowered from 18 to 16 to recognise that young people can experience abuse in their relationships. Holly, of course, was 15 at the time of her death, but it was said by the government then that they did not want to risk blurring the lines between domestic abuse and child abuse. We're joined by Susan Dungworth, who is the Labour Police and Crime Commissioner for Northumbria. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
The family of Holly would like the legal age for domestic abuse to be lowered in recognition of what happened to her. Do you support that idea?
Yes, I do. First of all, I would just like to add my condolences to Holly's family. I think Michaela, Lee and the rest of the family have behaved with real determination and passion to bring this to our attention. I think that there is an issue around coercive controlling relationships and violence amongst young people as well as adults. And I think we need to recognise that, and we need to review the law to make sure that is being reflected in the law. You know, Michaela is absolutely right. Although Holly was killed by a knife, actually she suffered abuse and stalking and harassment for a long time leading up to her death, and her murder was around domestic abuse, around relationships, a toxic relationship, rather than a one-off knife crime.
The statement that Michaela, Holly's mother, gave to the court does say that in previous times they looked like they were in a normal teenage relationship. But these are her words. As they got older, it was apparent that Holly was more mature than Logan and they were growing apart. I had no idea of the emotional turmoil that Holly was going through trying to end the relationship. Do you think that if the legal age for domestic abuse was lower, her case might have been seen differently, whether by her family or by school or others who saw the two together?
Possibly, although I do know that Holly's mum had started to recognise there was something seriously wrong with this relationship, as had Holly herself, and had contacted the police around the stalking and the harassment. I don't know that in other cases people necessarily will have the same awareness that Holly's mum did. And I think for professionals, for the police force, for social workers, for teachers, for family members, I think it is really important that we recognise that those same destructive and violent relationships that we know happen within the domestic violence world also do happen, can affect young people themselves. And my view is we need to look at this case, we need to look at other cases similar to that, and assure ourselves that we have the correct laws in place that, like you say, will flag up those concerns, but also just make people better aware and ensure that when people are sentenced, they are sentenced for the appropriate crime.
Because most of the time, do you think we see teenage relationships as something apart completely, you know, part of sort of turbulent time in your life when hormones are raging and much is changing?
Absolutely. And, you know, for the majority of teenage relationships, that is absolutely right. You know, it is about growing up. It's about learning how to relate to people. It's about learning about intimacy. And all that is good and right. And we should encourage, you know, good, healthy relationships. But on those cases, and Holly, it will not be alone, where it isn't right, we need to ensure that we've learned lessons from Holly's death about how young people like herself can fall victim, the same as her mum.
Susan Dunworth, thank you.
At 8:02, let's look at what's coming up on Radio 4.
Dickensian on BBC Radio 4.
The final completed work of Charles Dickens.
Mr. Rayburn has offered to teach me to read.
Oh, just that?
Of course. What else could there be, Lightwood?
Two love stories played out against a portrait of London life.
Brand new people in a brand new house in a brand new quarter of London entertaining brand new friends.
A classic tale with contemporary relevance.
Forgive me, but I do so want to be rich.
Dickensian, Our Mutual Friend, starts on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds tomorrow afternoon at 3.
Sarah Keith Lucas has the weekend weather for us. Morning, Sarah.
Morning, Michelle. Well, it's looking very settled out there. Pretty quiet weekend of weather. Mostly dry, lots of cloud around and mild for the time of year. So this morning we've got the odd spot of drizzle, particularly so for parts of East Anglia, the southeast of England, also northwest Scotland and Northern Ireland, seeing a little bit of fine drizzle in the air. But that should tend to ease away through the day. So we're all looking largely dry, I think, for much of the day. Sunny spells here and there. I think the best sunshine probably for parts of eastern Scotland, eastern England. Later on in the day, further south, we should see a few glimpses of blue sky. But generally, it is going to be fairly grey. Top temperatures between about 13 to 16 degrees north to south today. Into this evening and overnight, it stays fairly cloudy but dry. And tomorrow, a similar day. So we've still got that high pressure with us. Still largely dry but fairly cloudy and mild. Probably a little bit more sunshine tomorrow compared to today, especially across the northern half of the UK. Heading through the week ahead and high pressure still very much with us, we could see some dense mist and fog around to start the week, and then temperatures are going to gradually rise through next week.
Thanks, Sarah. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Michelle Hussain in London and Sean Farrington in Salford.
It's 8:00 on Saturday, the 2nd of November. Good morning. Our headlines today. Extra troops are being sent to help clean up after the deadly floods in eastern Spain, where more than 200 people have died. The polio vaccination programme is to resume in part of northern Gaza, after UN agencies described the situation for civilians there as apocalyptic. The Conservative Party is preparing to announce its new leader. We'll speak to our political editor, Chris Mason, before 9:00.
And coming up before 9, we'll talk to some young men about that viral clip of Saoirse Ronan from the Graham Norton show about women's safety and the incredible story of a woman who discovered she'd been swapped at birth through a DNA home test her son got for Christmas.
Pulled up outside the house. My brother was there. Got out. The car. And we just hugged. And he said, "Hi, sis." And then he says, come and meet Mum.
We'll have the full fascinating story at 8:20.
I'm Simon Mundy with your Saturday Sport. And as we look ahead to the start of the autumn rugby internationals with England against New Zealand in Twickenham, All Blacks legend Sean Fitzpatrick has his say on whether the visitors may have lost some of their sheen.
I don't think the aura has faded. Yeah, the All Blacks are still the All Blacks. Yeah, we've got a wonderful history, we've got a great legacy. But it's just the state of world rugby at the moment. The teams are so equal and competitive now.
The BBC News this morning is read by Tina Ritchie.
Spain is deploying hundreds of additional troops to the region of Valencia, where emergency services have struggled to respond to devastating floods. More than 200 people are known to have died so far, and dozens are unaccounted for. The floodwaters have overturned vehicles, swept bridges away, and covered towns in mud. Thousands of people living in cut-off communities are without electricity. Our correspondent Mark Lowen reports from the city of Valencia.
With every hour and every day, the hope of finding more survivors from Tuesday's catastrophic flooding dwindles, as rescuers reach new areas, picking their way through piles of smashed vehicles. The focus is shifting to retrieving the dead. Many bodies are believed to be in underground garages and car parks, trapped as the floodwaters rose. 500 more soldiers will arrive today, adding to the 1,700 already here. But the authorities are facing severe criticism for a slow response and for failing to warn people of the flooding in advance. Local volunteers have fanned out across the streets to fill the vacuum, clearing, sweeping, and talking of abandonment. And yet the regional government, which they blame for mismanagement, has urged them to stay home, saying they risked holding up the emergency services.
Kamala Harris and Donald Trump have held simultaneous rallies just a few miles apart as they try to secure votes in the key swing state of Wisconsin. Opinion polls suggest the two candidates to be president are neck and neck. Wisconsin is one of seven states which could be won by either the Democrats or the Republicans. Our correspondent Gary O'Donoghue reports from Milwaukee.
It's been a rough week for the former president, on the back foot over comments about women, Hispanics, and a suggestion that one opponent should face something akin to a firing squad. The crowd got some unusual treatment, a large gun-like object firing T-shirts into the audience. But it was the usual message from the candidate.
We're leading just about, I think, all seven swing states we're leading, but don't listen to me now. Just pretend we're one down, right? We're 1 point down, please. We don't want to say, oh, we don't have to vote today, Alice, because he's leading. No, don't do that.
Here in Wisconsin and across the other six swing states, Donald Trump and Kamala Harris are neck and neck. That's why they're ending up in the same places the whole time. This time, the vice president just 6 miles away. She was focusing on the economy, something where she has lagged behind Donald Trump.
I will give a middle-class tax cut to over 100 million Americans. We will enact the first ever federal ban on corporate price gouging on groceries.
It's now a battle for every last vote. No one knows how this one will end.
The World Health Organization says the second round of a mass polio vaccination program for Palestinian children in northern Gaza is to resume today. It said that although it would not be possible to reach all of those in need, going ahead now would reduce the risk to children overall. Our correspondent Joe Inwood reports from Jerusalem.
Polio had not been seen in Gaza for 25 years, until August, when it was confirmed a baby was partially paralysed by the virus. A vaccination campaign for more than 500,000 children began soon after, with the first round going relatively smoothly. But a second vaccination is needed. The UN says it reached the centre and south of the Strip, but not the north, due to the launch of a major Israeli air and ground assault. They now say they have assurances that a pause in the fighting will allow them to finish the work in Gaza City. There are, however, around 15,000 children in areas too dangerous to access.
The leaders of 15 UN agencies and humanitarian organisations have described conditions for civilians in northern Gaza as apocalyptic and warned that around 400,000 people were at imminent risk of death. They've accused Israel of blocking life-saving supplies from getting in during the operation against Hamas. Rosalia Bollin from UNICEF told us what her teams on the ground had been reporting.
20 schools that were turned into shelters have been hit in less than a two-week time span. And that results in a very, very high casualty toll. And the second thing is that those who do survive those bombings are prevented from accessing care. Hospitals are under attack. They're cut off supplies. They can barely function.
The result of the vote to choose a new Conservative Party leader will be announced at an event in central London this morning. Tory members have been choosing between the former Business Secretary, Kemi Badenoch, and the former Immigration Minister, Robert Jenrick. Here's our political correspondent, Ben Wright.
It's 4 months since the Tories were trounced at the election, and the party hasn't rushed the contest to replace Rishi Sunak as leader. After six candidates were winnowed down to a final pair by Conservative MPs, Robert Jenrick and Kemi Badenoch have been slugging it out to win the vote of Tory members. The rival candidates are both from the party's right. Mr. Jenrick put immigration at the centre of his campaign and criticised Kemi Badenoch for having no policies. But she argued the party had to rally around Conservative principles first. While polling of Tory members has suggested Kemi Badenoch has a clear lead over Mr. Jenrick, in recent days both candidates have said turnout looked low. Both know too that whoever wins today will take over a wounded party with an electoral mountain to climb.
The computer chip giant Nvidia is to join the Dow Jones Industrial Average for the first time. The company, which has grown dramatically in value because of its importance to the artificial intelligence sector, will replace the rival chipmaker Intel. That's being seen as a sign of the global boom in AI. Here's Keith Adams.
As the world grapples with the opportunities artificial intelligence offers, the appetite for hardware to make it work is soaring. Nvidia's chief executive, Jensen Huang, recently described demand for the company's next-generation AI chips as insane. The tech giant has developed technology that's tailor-made for AI software, giving it an advantage over its competition in the booming sector. It's now to replace Intel in the Dow Jones Industrial Average. That will smart for the chip-making rival, not least as Intel reportedly once considered buying Nvidia before its board resisted the move. Nvidia's stock market value is now more than $3 trillion, whereas Intel's has fallen below $100 billion.
The grand final of one of the world's most popular competitive computer games is being held in the UK today for the first time. The League of Legends World Championship final could break records for the most watched esports event of all time. Andrew Rogers reports.
If you're a fan of esports and competitive gaming, this is the big one. Tens of thousands will pack out London's O2 Arena later to cheer on the world's two best teams at League of Legends, a multiplayer battle arena video game. Millions are expected to watch online too. In a 5-against-5 format, China's top team BLG will take on the fan favourites T1 from Korea. No matter who lifts the trophy, today's event is being seen as a win for the economy, as fans have travelled from across the country and around the world to watch.
Manchester United's new manager Ruben Amorim has said he was told it was now or never when he tried to delay a deal until the end of the season. He's leaving the Portuguese champion Sporting Lisbon to take over at Old Trafford. He said he had just 3 days to make up his mind on something which radically changed his life, as Joe Linsky reports.
From November the 11th, he'll be United's new manager. But until then, Ruben Amorim is still in charge at Sporting. They played in a Portuguese league match last night and won 5-1. Afterwards, Amorim spoke for the first time since his appointment. He said he tried to stay at Sporting until the end of the season. But when pushed, United's answer was that the job was now or never. Amorim said he didn't want to have regrets and so agreed to join United at the next international break.
Joe Linsky reporting.
Tina, thank you very much. The time is 8:10. 3 days on from the budget, GP surgeries are among those hoping that the government might have a change of heart and limit the scope of raised employers' national insurance contributions for them. That seems unlikely since the Treasury Minister told the BBC that it will apply to them. More widely, can we, 3 days on, see this budget as a move to redistribute wealth from older to younger age groups, given the increase in the minimum wage for younger workers? And the higher tax on capital gains, which is more likely to apply to older people. Having said that, the Chancellor's changes to stamp duty will mean a greater proportion of first-time buyers will be paying that particular tax in the months to come. Let's hear two perspectives. First, Aisha, who is 18.
The fact that the minimum wage has been increased for under 25s is really important, and I'm really glad that that's finally happened. It's really quite crucial to me right now when I'm looking at certain jobs and I'm at the point where I'm really trying to go for anything, and I'm realizing that, you know, certain companies are definitely better at paying the living wage and others will kind of tell you that they're paying the living wage, but only if you're over 25. So the fact that it's increasing for under 25s does make me very happy.
Here's another perspective though. Sue, who is a pensioner from Manchester.
These inheritance tax reforms have totally blown a hole in our pension plan. We've worked all our lives and saved. I'm 72. My husband is just about to be 80. He actually worked until he was 74. Neither of us have degrees, not high earners. We try to arrange our finances so as to plan for a measured, independent retirement. My husband's plan to provide for me when he dies will need me now to review my situation so as not adversely impact on my future and that of our 30-something daughter.
Let's hear first then from Simon Jack, our business editor, who has spent all week digging into the budget, the actual day of the budget, and then the days afterwards. Simon, how much would you say there is to support the idea that there is an age-focused redistribution in this budget?
Plenty. I think if you look at the shape of this very big budget, you have got, the boomers, if you like, the 57 to 75s, have got most of the property. They've got the big generous pension schemes. They're more likely to own shares. And they've got £2.7 trillion worth of housing, most of which is mortgage-free. So you've seen some of the measures in the budget, for example, bringing pension pots into the inheritance tax orbit, extend the inheritance tax threshold for another 2 years, as you say, increase capital gains tax, inheritance tax on farmland to sort of have a nibble at the transfer of generational wealth there, and also get rid of the exemption on AIM shares. Again, that's another thing that people planning for retirement often own, and their exemption will be abolished as well with a 20% tax on that. If you compare that to, as you were hearing, a 16% rise in the national living wage, for 18 to 20-year-olds, a 6.7% inflation-busting pay raise for 21 and above. You also look at greater working rights, more secure employment from those, from that raft of plethora of new rights and protections, plus more affordable housing and a promise to get tough on people who object to new planning applications, NIMBYs, more likely to be older people. Then you can see a real shape in this, that if you like, this big transfer of wealth as the baby boomers come to the twilight of their lives, there's going to be a big wealth transfer. I think the government wants to get in the middle of that, insert itself, and get a little bit of the money out of that transfer to give a better start in life, if you like, a more secure, better paid future, more affordable housing for people at the other end of the spectrum who can make a bit more of a start in life. Now, have they done that right? I think you'll find that businesses who got the biggest bill of this £45 billion tax raising budget would say they've put a little bit too much, their slice of the bill is a bit too much, and that might be to the detriment ultimately of workers. But I think you can see a definite shape of intergenerational planning in this.
Simon, thank you very much. And let's turn now to David Willetts, Lord Willetts, who's president of the Resolution Foundation. That's a think tank focused on those on lower incomes, and who's also written a book called The Pinch, How the Baby Boomers Took Their Children's Future and Why They Should Give It Back. Lord Willetts, good morning.
Good morning, Michelle.
Do you agree with Simon Jack's assessment of the overall shape of the budget, and is it in line with what you want?
Yeah, I hope Simon's right. And it's an impressive list he's just given us of these measures. And it would be great if they do indeed offer a better deal to younger generation. And if they do, we at Resolution will support it. There are some tricky angles to look out for. I mean, I think, for example, on wages, it is great that we're seeing this particularly sharp increase in the minimum wage for people aged 18 to 20. And the government's clearly got an objective of narrowing the gap between the minimum wage for 18 to 20 year olds and the national living wage for people who are older. There is a danger at some point these increases are going to have an effect on the number of jobs available. And the Low Pay Commission needs to track that. We've got one warning sign already, which is the increase in the number of young people who are not in education, employment or training. So we may face a trade-off in the future where, as we keep on increasing the wages, we start seeing an employment effect amongst young people. So I hope this works, but we have to make sure it doesn't have the perverse effect of lowering job opportunities for young people.
Or lowering wages, because the employers are going to pay those in, or not lowering, but depressing wages, or depressing wage increases, or affecting bonuses, because the employers paying those extra national insurance contributions will find it from somewhere.
Yes, indeed. And the OBR's assessment of the budget did show that actually, in terms of earnings and incomes over the life of this parliament, if anything, there's a slight improvement in the early years with the stimulus of the extra spending, but it doesn't look as if there's a big effect on improving the nation's growth rate over the full 5 years. So at the end of the 5 years, it's not clear really much extra progress has been made. So, look, I support anybody who's trying to help younger people and they're doing their best. And, of course, they would say you're actually going to get more people want, young people wanting to work if they see a higher wage. But already, of those young people who are out of the labour market, not in education, employment, training, 60% say the reason they're in that position is they're finding it hard to find a job. Mm. So we should remember, we need to promote job creation.
You're talking about really unintended consequences, aren't you? And I wonder if there's one other aspect of the budget we could pick out on that, the capital gains tax on second homes. Are you, when you hear from people who have properties, landlords, and they're saying they're putting them on the market because of extra taxes, do you worry that that is going to affect the availability of rental property?
Well, again, there's a trade-off. Nothing is straightforward in life. But clearly, what the government are trying to do is to get more houses on the market for sale, and hoping that'll then help first-time buyers, particularly younger people. And it's and there's a modest improvement at the moment going on in the number of young people buying their houses, but they're still behind previous generations. But the squeeze will then be in the private rented sector. And that's already very tight, and private rents. And now young people are increasingly in the private rented sector. So there's a balance there. And they have not particularly helped the younger people who need some housing benefit help or benefit help to get started to cover their private rents. And the special stamp duty lower rate for first time buyers, that exemption, that favour is going to disappear. So if they can get building more houses, fantastic. They're right to try to reform planning laws. They're right to try to get more housing on the market. But it's a pity that this transaction tax of stamp duty is bearing so much of a burden, because in general, we want to see a market that's moving with more buying and selling. I think the least fair of the property taxes is council tax. That's what really needs reform. And that's what hits people in low value properties, including, of course, many private tenants who end up paying the council tax as well. So the council tax still needs reform, and a government with a large majority at the start of its parliament could have been the moment Finder said about that.
Yeah. Sean, I wonder what your thoughts are, because you spent all week embedded in the budget.
Yeah, well, and embedded in a few businesses along the way as well. Yeah, for quite a period. Yeah, I just wonder, Lord Willits, when I was at this Jamaican patty factory in southeast London on Monday, and I was at Birmingham Wholesale Market Thursday as well, and when you look around and you see the younger workers there, if all of a sudden those employers who were telling me all week, if the costs go up as much as they do for them, then they're going to have to think about not recruiting, about maybe having to get rid of people. I just wonder, is there a tranche of maybe a small generation of younger workers who won't see the benefit of that long-term redistribution just yet, but they are in the jobs market right now and they need a job right now, and their employers may not be recruiting them the way they were?
Well, that is the risk. And look, it's going to be really important to track this closely, because if you look at all the labour market measures, I mean, 0 hours contracts, which for many people are onerous, but for some people it's how they want to operate in the labour market. You know, it's young people in particular who are on 0 hours contracts, which are going to be banned. So we will see. And there's a really important role for the Low Pay Commission here to monitor whether all these different changes are having the benign effect of simply boosting the incomes of young people, or whether the combined effect of the increased tax on employers, the increase in the minimum wage for 18 to 20-year-olds, where all that starts seeing young people losing job opportunities. And I tell you, I think the flashing light to look out for is young people who are NEET, young people not in education, employment or training. That's been rising for the last 2.5 years. If it went, and it's going up, it's about 900,000. If that went through 1 million, if we had more than 1 million young people NEET, that would be a really bad sign that this system was no longer working for young people in the jobs market.
Lord Willits, thank you very much. David Willits, President of the Resolution Foundation.
21 minutes past eight, and you can now get the second series of the podcast, The Gift, on BBC Sounds, which tells the stories of the unintended consequences of at-home DNA tests, including this experience of two families in the West Midlands still waiting for compensation after Joan, who's now 83, discovered she'd brought the wrong baby girl home from hospital 57 years ago. And she discovered that after her son was given an Ancestry DNA test as a Christmas gift in 2022. The clip you're about to hear is Joan's daughter Claire going to meet her mum and her brother Tony for the very first time.
I was very nervous. Oh my God, this isn't happening. I'm going to wake up in a minute. Pulled up outside the house. My brother was there. Got out. The car. We just hugged. And he said, "Hi, sis." And then he says, come and meet Mum. So went in the house. And she was there. And we just embraced and we sobbed. We sobbed. And I looked at her and I said, "Oh my God, I've got your eyes. We have the same eyes. Oh my God, I look like someone."
Did you feel a connection immediately?
Yes. It was so bizarre, like we'd always known each other. There was no hesitation, it was just instant. We spent the whole afternoon chatting. Mum got lots and lots of photos out, and then I suddenly realised, oh my goodness, look at all these people. I'm related to all these people.
Well, Jenny Kleeman is the host of The Gift on Radio 4, joins us now. Jenny, good morning to you. An emotional one to make, I bet.
Really, really emotional. Yes, a real honour to make it.
And tell us a little bit more about, you know, how this came about, and maybe how it's a little bit different to the first series that people might have experienced.
Yeah, so the gift is about the fact that we casually give each other DNA tests for Christmas and for birthdays. It's the present for the person who already has everything. And it's about the extraordinary truths that have been revealed through people taking these tests, because so many people have taken them now that there's a kind of global database in the cloud that secrets assumed forever hidden are being forced into the light. And in fact, I know this story because Joan, who is in her 80s, listened to the first series of The Gift and found me online and contacted me to tell me this story, that her son had been given a DNA test for Christmas. And it turns out that when he got his results, everything looked completely normal. The area of Ireland that his mother's family comes from was there, a cousin was there, and his sister was there, but the sister had the wrong name. The sister was someone called Claire, whereas the sister he grew up with was called Jessica. And when he contacted this person, Claire, who had also been given a DNA test as a gift, they discovered that Claire had been born around the same time in the same hospital as Jessica, the sister that he had been brought up with. And they worked out that there had been some kind of mistake at the hospital and the two babies had been swapped at birth 55 years earlier.
Incredible. How prevalent are you suspecting this is? Have you heard others getting in touch when you've dug a bit deeper? Is this becoming more of a thing now as people get these tests?
Extraordinary stories are emerging from people taking these tests. So, you know, crimes are being solved because of people taking these tests, malpractice and mistakes at IVF clinics, and all sorts of other things, adoption stories where people have extraordinary pasts. But this is the first and only known documented case of babies being swapped in NHS history. And the hospital responsible, the trust that oversees that hospital, has admitted liability. And it is the first case in NHS records of this actually happening. And it only came to light because of people taking DNA tests they'd been given as gifts.
And is there an expectation that compensation, you know, will arrive in a timely manner now that the story is being told so widely?
Well, I think the family would hope so. They were told that they would be getting compensation. They were expecting to receive it last year. I mean, Joan, as you say, is 83, and I think she's finding the waiting quite difficult. NHS Resolution has said to us that it is a unique and complex case involving multiple parties, and they're working closely with the legal team to agree the amount of compensation due. But yes, the family is still waiting 2.5 years after the NHS admitted liability for this.
And what can we expect from the whole of the series? Because we can get the first couple of episodes fresh this morning and then the whole 6 episodes roll out on Monday. Is it going to be more of this kind of storytelling and getting into the depths of it all?
Yes, very different stories. Stories about donor conception. There is a story about how someone taking a DNA test to find out whether or not she had a cancer gene managed to unearth a baby-selling ring in Canada in the 1950s. All sorts of different stories about identity, genealogy and technology. What happens when that all collides, the truths that are unearthed.
Wow, it'll make people think a little bit differently if they're just casually going to be giving one of those DNA tests away this Christmas.
Absolutely. I think there is nothing casual about DNA tests. I had to take one for the first series of The Gift and get my results with my producer there recording me. But I found out that I was boring, and it is really much better to be boring than interesting when it comes to DNA tests.
Well, I'm not sure about the solidity of those conclusions, Jenny. Look forward very much to hearing the podcast on BBC Sounds, The Gift on Radio 4 as well in the coming days. But subscribe now.
All of our faces in here as that clip was played of Claire, and yours too, Jenny. Yeah. Do you find it an emotional series
incredibly,
to work on?
Incredibly emotional. I'm a tough reporter, but I was in tears interviewing her. I cannot imagine what it must be like to learn that about yourself and have your life turned upside down. So it was incredibly emotional.
Looking forward to hearing the rest of the series. Thanks so
Thank
much.
You.
Simon's here with the sport.
Thank you. Yes, Rugby Union's Autumn Internationals gets underway this afternoon. Scotland play Fiji at Murrayfield at 5:40. But first, it's England against New Zealand in Twickenham at 3:10. This is arguably the most enticing of fixtures for England rugby fans. But what about for the visiting All Blacks? Earlier, I spoke to the former New Zealand captain, Sean Fitzpatrick.
It's huge. And, you know, after what we saw in the summer and how close those two games were in New Zealand, I think the expectations are pretty high that it'll be a close encounter. And for me personally, having played at Twickenham against England, knowing how difficult it is to win at Twickenham, the All Blacks are under no illusions how tough this is going to be.
Sean, you recently said, I think a lot of teams will look at New Zealand and think they can win. Why has the aura faded somewhat, would you say? And how painful is that for players, coaches and fans?
I don't think the aura has faded. Yeah, the All Blacks are still the All Blacks. Yeah, we've got a wonderful history, we've got a great legacy. But it's just the state of world rugby at the moment. The teams are so equal and competitive now that the days of winning 23, 25 internationals on the trot, I think it's gone. Even South Africa, I'd classify as teams that can be beaten on any given day, and that's the same as the All Blacks.
Beauden Barrett, due to start at fly half, expected to line up alongside his brothers. Is he the biggest attacking threat, and who else should the fans be watching out for?
Beauden is the most unbelievable player. He's just a sensational 10, and we're happy to have him there. But, you know, we're excited. Geordie Barrett's back at 12. There's a number of guys. You know, we've got a big 4 weeks ahead of us, so it's going to be an effort by everyone to make sure that we sort of get the tour off to a good start.
Speaking of world-class players, you've narrated a documentary about the great Jonah Lomu, which is available to watch now on TNT Sports. Now, many people see him as a player who transcended the sport. Would you agree with that? And what was he like when he wasn't running over England players? Because you knew him well.
Without question, he is the greatest global superstar rugby has ever had. And I don't think we'll ever replicate that ever again. And he did that in the space of 5-6 games in 1995. And unfortunately, he was lost at such a young age. So the documentary covers a lot of that time. And he was one of our greats and a very humble man. We speak a lot in the All Blacks about humility. And he personified that.
And Jonah Lomu's legacy lives on, doesn't it? Tupo Vahi is in the All Blacks side. His family, originally from Tonga, he went to the same school as Lomu, and he said that made him believe he could become an All Black himself. So it's a nice sort of story there.
It's great. It's wonderful. That's what, you know, New Zealand in terms of sport, really. It's not just rugby, but Nanjiana and Wesley College, where he went to school, have been a great example over the years of giving children an opportunity, kids that are at risk, giving them sport, because, you know, sport has the ability to change lives. That's exactly what, you know, happened in Jonah's case, without question.
Sean Fitzpatrick, a pleasure talking to you. Thanks for speaking to the Today programme.
Okay, mate. Thank you.
The documentary on Jonah Lomu, called The Lost Tapes, is available now on TNT and Discovery Plus. Full radio commentary of both England against New Zealand and the later fixture, Scotland against Fiji, is on 5 Live Sports Extra and BBC Sounds.
Cheers, Simon. Saturday Live is at 9. Here's Nikki Beddy to tell us more.
Our Saturday Live guests today are comedian and unspeakable lexicographer Phil Wang, Chitra Sounder. She's the creator behind the new BBC series Nikhil and Jay, about two mixed heritage boys. Wish I'd had those stories when I was growing up. And former police officer turned hit TV creator Nigel McCreary will be with us. He's the man behind Silent Witness and New Tricks, who's also had an entire royal family in the boot of his car. Intrigued? Me too. All that, plus we have the inheritance tracks of former Time Lord Peter Capaldi. If you'd like to be in touch with us, do email saturdaylive@bbc.co.uk and we'll join you just after the news at 9.
Thank you, Nikki. The weather, a mostly cloudy and mild day with the chance of a few spots of light rain.
The time is 32 minutes past 8. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Michelle Hussain in London, Sean Farrington in Salford, and in London with a summary of the news, Tina Ritchie.
Spain is sending an extra 500 soldiers to the Valencia region to assist in the rescue effort for this week's catastrophic floods. More than 200 people are known to have died and dozens remain unaccounted for. Some residents are angry with the authorities for what they see as their poor preparation and response to the disaster. Kamala Harris and Donald Trump have held simultaneous rallies in the swing state of Wisconsin as they try to secure key votes. Wisconsin is one of seven states which will determine the outcome of the election. The Conservative Party leadership race will come to a close this morning when a winner is declared. Tory members have been voting to decide between the former business secretary, Kemi Badenoch, and the former immigration minister, Robert Jenrick. The computer chip giant NVIDIA is to join the Dow Jones Industrial Average next week. The company has surged in value because of its importance to the artificial intelligence sector. NVIDIA will replace its rival chip maker, Intel, which has struggled to keep up with the global boom in AI.
Thanks, Tina. Now, we're going to continue the conversation that you may have heard Nick having on yesterday's programme with his daughter Alice about the level of threat women face going about their day-to-day lives. They were talking about the point made by the actress Saoirse Ronan on Graham Norton's show last week after the fellow actors Paul Mescal, Denzel Washington and Eddie Redmayne spoke about how Eddie had learned how to protect himself for a scene.
Find some of the techniques, though, that you learned. Like, some of the things Paul taught us is how you can use your phone if someone's attacking you, the butt of your phone, right, to go...
Yeah, who's actually going to think about that, though? If someone attacks me, I'm not going to go, phone.
I agree.
Hang on a second.
One second.
That's a very good point. Yeah.
That's what girls have to think about all the time.
Yeah.
Am I right, ladies?
Now, after hearing that, Alice Robinson told her dad, Nick, what she thought he knew about women's experiences and spoke as well about the types of moments she'd had.
I was on a bus in the front seats of a double-decker bus at the top, and a man stood behind me on the stairs, even though there were loads of seats free, so that's weird already. And people had to squeeze past him to get on and off, and then he came and sat next to me. And I know it doesn't sound like a big thing, but he'd already shown himself to be, like, unusual. I felt incredibly uncomfortable. There are two different strategies that probably lots of women are thinking about. A, I can leave that seat as soon as possible and get off. But if I do that, then he knows that I'm getting off at the next stop. So then is that safe? Because he could follow me off the bus. Or the other strategy is to stay in my seat as long as possible and leave myself physically vulnerable there and then run off at my stop so he can't follow me off. But then I'm leaving myself vulnerable on the bus.
So how aware are men about the extent of these experiences that, as Alice laid out, happen pretty much every day in one form or another? I'm joined by Owen, who's a 21-year-old living in Dagenham, and Will, 19-year-old student at Lincoln. Will, good morning to you both.
Morning.
Owen, just firstly, on that clip that went viral, when you first saw it and saw the men discussing and then Saoirse Ronan having to make that point, what did you think?
When I saw the clip, it was just a clear example of how male and females perceive different experiences differently. So from her perspective, she was speaking from experience, speaking on behalf of other women, whilst the males there were seeing the funny side of it, the jokey side of it, which wasn't intending to hurt or harm anyone, but it just shows how two different genders perceive two different situations.
Do you find that amongst your friends? Is this the kind of thing you talk about yourselves?
Well, within my friendship group, we've actually got quite a lot of us girls, so partners, girlfriends. So when we tend to have these conversations, and when we have them conversations, they tend to be a bit more serious because we've had friends that have experienced things in the past which ain't the greatest. So when we have that discussion with our friends, we tend to be a bit more sensitive.
Will, what about for you? Do you find that, you know, when you hear Alice's example there, would that be one that you would already know is happening very regularly, or when you hear it, is it a shock?
No. Sorry,
that one to Will, Owen.
I think straight away it's just a lack of education, because you don't hear these stories all the time, but I know it happens all the time in normal society, everyday society, and I think it should be a big thing that people should be educated on, and if you do see it in the public, try and stand up for it or try and do something to make sure they feel comfortable. I think it happens way too often and it's way too common for stuff like this to happen. It's very scary, especially this world, this bus story, which I read on the news the other day. I thought it happens way too often, and I think people should be educated more on it and how to deal with it as a bystander.
Just want to bring in another comment that Alice made in that discussion with Nick, another common situation she described.
Men stare at women in a way that makes you very uncomfortable, but they don't do it in front of other men. So it becomes like this mass thing where men who don't do that don't realise that that's a thing.
Owen, do you talk to your own male friends about this, not necessarily with women present, about, you know, another situation there where you have men regularly just staring at women?
Within my male friendship group, I wouldn't say that's something we talk about. It doesn't come up in conversation. The only time it's actually brought up is maybe when we're out with our girls and someone said that the guy over there by the bar is looking at me very creepily, but we haven't noticed because we don't pay attention to stuff like that. So
is that part of the problem? If you know, as men, we're not actually discussing these things without a woman being present, just like on the Graham Norton show in our sort of social activities every weekend, that we're not looking at and raising these points as often as we should.
Yeah, I do. I totally agree. I do believe that's part of the problem. And I think that does come from lack of education, lack of awareness, where we wouldn't, as males, we wouldn't deem this to be a normal conversation to have simply because we don't experience it. So it's a bit of stupidity from us, if that makes sense.
Will, what could you do to get you and your male mates talking about this more? Because it sounds like you and Owen are aware of these things and may well be taking steps of a weekend after a night out to make women feel a little less that they're in this situation yourselves. But if all your friendship group aren't doing the same, how can you make them act differently?
I think straight away, just education, like Owen said. So learn how to deal with these situations, whether it's go to talk to someone, let's say you're at a nightclub, you see someone looking at you a bit weirdly. I'd go to someone straight away, to security, say, look, this guy's being a bit weird, making me feel uncomfortable. Either walk away or go away or get them out. I think you got to look at, you could never leave someone alone on a night out, especially if they feel vulnerable. So walk them home or even just make sure that they stay away or the person stays away from the person who's being a bit weird in that sense. I think it would be a huge opportunity for someone who's acting vulnerable to be taken advantage of in that sense by following them. I think people should be more educated on how to deal with it, because if they were, this conversation should be common knowledge to some people, but some people out there, they haven't even thought about how to deal with this on a night out in this situation. So Owen, I think it should be common.
Sorry to interrupt you there, Will. I just wondered, Owen, is this one that you could be bringing up with your friends today, raise the topic later in the cafe or the bars as you're all hanging out?
Yeah, for sure. I'm seeing some of my mates later. We're going out for a meal to celebrate one of my mates' birthdays. And then from there, we're going out after. So it is a conversation that I will bring up with my mates later and just see how the conversation flows, because it's nice when you're able to educate each other and have more appropriate conversations with your friends.
And just finally, I mean, are there ways that you will behave differently? Not just tonight, but just generally on a night out, if, you know, we're in that situation that so many of us are, we're all going home on our own at some point. Are you aware of the women around you when you're doing that?
Yes, I am aware. I do have a sister and female friends who've spoke from experience. So when I've been told certain things, I try to change what I do to cater and make others feel comfortable. And it's just the small things that maybe smiling, just crossing the road, leaving a bit of space in front of you. It's just the little things that help settle the ease and nerves.
Owen, Will, thank you so much for talking to us about this morning. Owen there from Dagenham and Will from Lincoln.
It is now 22 minutes to nine, and almost exactly 4 months since election defeat for the Conservatives, the party's new leader is to be announced this morning. The last stage for the last few weeks has been Robert Jenrick versus Kemi Badenoch, and one of them will take over the party in the immediate aftermath of a momentous Labour budget. Chris Mason, our political editor, joins us. I imagine you'd be huddled into a room later on this morning, Chris, to hear the result. How close do you think the voting has been?
Yeah, morning to you. So that result coming in just over 2 hours, a little after 11 o'clock this morning at a venue in central London. A contest for a job that recent precedent suggests won't lead to being Prime Minister. So when the Conservatives last lost big time in 1997, it took them 13 years and four leaders to make it back to power. For Labour, turfed out in 2010, 14 years and three leaders before they were back. Nonetheless, it has been a keenly fought contest. In this last two, with Kemi Badenoch and Robert Jenrick, the assumption has been, ever since that they became the final two, that Kemi Badenoch was the person to beat. But then again, polling the Conservative Party membership, 100,000-odd people scattered hither and thither around the UK, is not easy. And we saw in the earlier rounds of this contest the capacity for surprise, so we wait and see.
They'll get told just before everyone else does. Is that right? I think that's how it happened last time.
Yeah, so you have to... The final act of being a contestant to be the Conservative Party leader is to have the ultimate poker face, because they each get a green room, and then there is a neutral room into which they are both invited just before 11. They are told together the result, and obviously can congratulate and commiserate between themselves. They then walk out into the room, where I'll be and lots of Conservative Party members will be, and we'll be studiously looking at their facial expressions. And then there's a bit of blurb and a bit of chat, and then the result, and then a speech from the winner, and an official car and a trip to Conservative headquarters and signing papers and getting security briefings and all that kind of stuff. And the loser hails a cab home.
Yeah. Well, it'll be fascinating to see whoever the winner is, what they say in that speech, and then pretty soon afterwards, who they choose to be in their shadow cabinet.
Yeah, so that their first speech, if you like, talking directly to the country as opposed to the party from whom they've been courting votes in the last few weeks. Then the assembly of a shadow cabinet, that'll take place over the next couple of days. That first Prime Minister's questions appearance on Wednesday. And so what we're getting this weekend is the next big sort of personality, if you like, of the politics of the months and years to come, after the big tranche of policy from the budget the other day, and straight into that debate and discussion that you were having with Simon and Lord Willetts in the last half hour, the new leader will plunge.
Yes. And then on that note about the budget, the overall message, I mean, we were talking earlier about the overall shape of it, but now 3 days on, as you look at it, I mean, we'll all remember when the Labour mantra was, we are going to grow the economy, we are going to grow the economy. The overall message of this first and momentous Labour budget doesn't seem to be about that, doesn't seem to be about delivering that.
No, and certainly the sort of backlash from some quarters has diluted, I think, any attempt from the centre to have that central message. So we see the argument, don't we, about care homes, about social care, about GP surgeries, about farmers, for instance. And we see some pushback this morning from the government. So the Prime Minister writing in the Financial Times, Pat McFadden, one of the most senior and influential ministers in the government, writing in the Times, trying to grip a sense of the agenda of the budget. And I guess move back to an argument they were making a couple of weeks ago, which is quite big, arguably amorphous, but they say ultimately the reality, which is one of, to use their phrase, fixing the foundations in this initial instance, in the hope that in the future you get the growth that remains their central mission. Interestingly, in the FT, the Prime Minister talking about the importance of planning reform, a desire for a big build that could become as transformative to working people as the Big Bang was for the City of London in the 1980s, he says, writing very much for the FT's audience, and making the point that planning reform wasn't scored, to use the Westminster language, in the forecasts around growth because it's complicated, it's painstaking, trying to offer, I guess, some sort of explanation for why those growth figures look pretty weak, even though that is that central driving mission of the government.
Live coverage of on BBC News, of course, of the Conservative Party election result later. Chris Mason, thank you.
Just coming up to 12 minutes to 8, we've had a wealth of your suggestions this week for spooky Halloween-themed books. So let's hear one last one from you. Sarah's suggestion may leave you looking very differently at certain garden objects after reading it.
My name's Sarah, and the book I would recommend is The Haunting of Aveline Jones by Phil Hicks. It is a brilliant, eerie page-turner of a ghost story. Our curious heroine loves ghost stories, and when she's stuck without the internet, she picks up an old ghost story book, and there are mysterious messages in it. The story is set during a windy, wet half term, so it's great to read during a windy, wet half term. And it's set in a beautifully described empty seaside village in Cornwall. And the story has a stern aunt, strange sounds in the night, windy cliffs, grey seas, and some very strange scarecrows. There are lovely pen and ink illustrations all the way through the book, and it adds to the uncanny feel. And I guarantee you will have goosebumps, and you will probably never look at scarecrows the same way ever again. So I hope you enjoy it. Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah. Yeah, scarecrows, if you've got one of those in your back garden, it might be a bit of a different take on it now. I just had a quick search. Reading age 9+. I'm getting very used to checking when to introduce these books into the home. So that sounds like a cracking one. Right, it's 10 to 8 now. North Korea has sent more than 10,000 troops to Russia to potentially train and fight in Ukraine, according to the Pentagon. A deepening military cooperation which doesn't just cause alarm in the West. It gives China a huge headache because Beijing, long been Pyongyang's most important ally, but President Xi Jinping has also been frustrated with North Korea and the instability it brings, particularly with its nuclear weapons program and threats to annihilate South Korea. Our China correspondent, Laura Bicker, took a trip to the border where China, North Korea and Russia all meet.
Dozens of curious Chinese tourists have travelled hundreds of miles for a chance to see three countries at one time. Here in the northeast, China owns just a sliver of land and is sandwiched between Russia and North Korea.
There's a real contrast between the two sides. The North Korean side, you have quite a high fence surrounded by barbed wire. Then you have the river. And then there's a line of North Korean fence with watchtowers. On the Russian side, well, it's just a simple fence. You could crawl over it quite easily. And there's a gate with a couple of signs on it saying, don't go through.
Further north, tour groups huddle together on the top of a 12-storey tower to take photos next to three overlapping flags on the wall. This is the point where China, Russia and North Korea meet. Peering at their Korean neighbours seems to be the main attraction.
North Korea has always been our neighbour. But to be able to see how they live makes me feel how prosperous and strong our country is. Here, our mobile phones have good enough pixels, which can look into their land.
I feel as a Chinese woman, I am very proud. Having Russia on my left and North Korea on my right. There are no borders among the peoples.
Everybody's good friends.
Yeah.
This view might be overly optimistic. Like the Chinese territory she has travelled to see, Beijing is caught between its neighbours, allies that appear to be spiralling out of its control. Fears of the growing friendship between Vladimir Putin and Kim Jong-un have peaked in the last few weeks. The US has said it's seen evidence that Pyongyang has sent 3,000 troops to Russia for a possible deployment to Ukraine, claims we put to the Chinese Foreign Ministry.
Now the floor is open to questions.
What is China's reaction to having both its allies and its close neighbours potentially involved in a conflict in Ukraine? And can China really claim that it is absolutely neutral in this war when President Xi stands shoulder to shoulder with President Putin?
On the Ukraine crisis, China's position is constant and clear. That is, that China hopes all parties to de-escalate the situation and promote political settlement.
Back at the border, as tourists photograph the bridge that links Russia and North Korea, the atmosphere is friendly. But this deepening alliance is not in President Xi's best interests. Christopher Green from the International Crisis Group explains.
The Chinese are concerned that Russia might share with North Korea the kind of military technology that could lead to instability on China's northeastern border. China benefits from North Korea's existence. Traditionally, we've thought of it as a buffer state for the Chinese to keep the capitalists away from China's borders. And destabilization on some level could even benefit Vladimir Putin in a way it really would not benefit Xi Jinping.
Oh, we're still being followed? Yeah, they're still behind us.
Our presence at the border was noticed by the police, and while it seems tourists are welcome, journalists are not.
Yeah, so they've just blocked the road to the port, which is usually a sign that they don't want us to go there. Time to get out.
We were in public areas at all times, and yet the team was stopped, repeatedly questioned, followed, and our footage was deleted. It seems this topic is sensitive to China. Still followed, we head to the airport. Beijing does not want to be seen as part of what some in the West have labelled an axis of evil. If President Xi continues to stand back, he risks an emboldened Kim ramping up tensions further. South Korea is already looking to NATO and the US to intervene. China now seems to be stuck in the middle as Western anxiety grows.
That was Laura Bicker reporting. It is 5 to 9. Jonathan Coe has, over many novels, focused his lens on moments in our recent history. It was the 1970s in What a Carve-Up and the Rotters Club. It was Brexit Britain in Middle England. There's been non-fiction too, and many other novels, of which the latest is The Proof of My Innocence, which the blurb tells us is part set in the Truss era. He is with us now in the studio. I feel the Truss era is not a long period in which to even part set a novel, Jonathan.
Yeah, it just seemed a nice self-contained moment, really, of 7 weeks in which you could set a story. And also, you know, a very dramatic moment, and 2 years on, in retrospect, a rather a strange moment. So that was the genesis of the book, in a way.
So how have you used it? What's the story that you weave around it?
Well, it's not a book about Liz Truss or her government. The starting point for it, actually, was a couple of years ago when I was watching television coverage of a conference which featured a lot of writers, thinkers, journalists, political figures from the kind of the more hard right-wing spectrum of the conservative movement. And it set me thinking about, you know, again, how far we've moved from consensus politics and how polarized our politics has become. And at the same time, the more mischievous part of my brain, I'd noticed that the bookshops were full at the moment of cozy crime. And I thought that if you took a conference like this and relocated it to a nice kind of sandstone country house hotel in the Cotswolds, it would be a good setting for a cozy crime mystery. So that's what I decided to write.
So you've brought murder mystery into what political commentary is what you've often done in, you know, with obviously within a world of fiction and with larger than life characters.
Yeah, I mean, I was interested in how radicalised on both sides of the Atlantic the conservative movement has become, seems to have become during my lifetime, and you know, and we're about to see that today. I think in the item you were just broadcasting about the new conservative leader, whichever one of the two it is, you know, it's not going to be a compromise or consensus figure. The other thing I noticed about this, what a lot of the speakers were saying at this conference, was this interesting story that people had started to tell about having been in government for 12 or 14 years but not in power, and how, you know, the institutions, the judiciary, academia, the media had been kind of captured by their ideological opponents, and that was where real power is located in the country. And I thought that was an interesting narrative that people have started to spin for themselves. And really, the beyond the politics and beyond the murder mystery, what the book is about is storytelling and what kind of stories we tell to ourselves to make sense of, you know, the chaos of our experience, whether it's in politics or in our everyday lives.
But do you think you personally, or you as a writer, you are angrier about Britain today than you have been in the past? Your book about Brexit did seem to have that, angry at the result, angry at the Conservatives.
I don't think this is a feeling unique to me. You know, I think there's a general feeling among people that whichever party is in power, things have gone wrong in the last few decades. That the infrastructure of the country is broken, that basic things that we used to take for granted, like the transport network, the NHS, and so on, are not functioning in the way that they should. That something has gone wrong.
So, do you feel heartened now? The country voted for change. We've had the budget, the first budget of that new government.
I think it's too soon to leap to judgment about what kind of government the Starmer government is going to be. I think they're operating in a very hostile media environment, and you know, already people have been very quick to judge them. But my novel about the Starmer years is several years off, I think.
Several, because you do one about every 2 years, don't you? So perhaps your next one might have to be set in this new era.
It might be. I mean, whatever it is, I will come back to the crime writing genre, I think, because it's very satisfying kind of writing for writers and for readers. It's the kind of purest kind of storytelling in a way, because you begin with chaos and mystery, and then if you do it properly, then you end up with resolution and closure, and that's really what everybody wants from their novels.
You sold